Coming up on Boston Public Radio, CNN's John King starts us off explaining how a dismissal of the problem in the morning became a White House admission in the afternoon that the U.S. leadership should have been marching in Paris. Then the world is celebrating free speech in the wake of the killings in Paris, chanting Je suis Charlie. But are we? How free is speech here at home? We'll discuss that with you. Then it's Ask the Commissioner with William Evans from the Boston Police Department. He'll take your questions and ours on a post-Ferguson and Staten Island world and keeping Boston safe during a possible Olympics.
New Governor Charlie Baker talks a good game about closing the achievement gap and fixing education. How? We'll ask our education expert. Then lots of us talk a good game about ditching the dreary office culture and working in freedom at home. We'll ask you about the pros and cons of working in your pajamas. And finally, Jared Bowen on the newest in stage and screen all around town, coming up on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk. Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hey, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So yesterday, we spent a lot of time discussing this on the show. In a moment of self-awareness, the White House finally conceded that they should have sent a top U.S. official to the Paris rally on Sunday. Meanwhile, GOP presidential hopefuls, members of a party that once had a penchant for remember Freedom Fries, changing the name to Liberty Fries on Capitol Hill, denounces the president for snubbing France. Joining us on the line to take on these and other political headlines is CNN's chief national correspondent, John King, also the host of the Sunday morning show Inside Politics. Hey there, John.
Happy AFC Championship Week.
You are unbelievable. We'll get
I
to
know.
That.
I'm not a big football fan, but even I was like, oh, my
unreal.
God, talk about a nail biter. Anyway, John King, Senator John Kerry, now, of course, Secretary of State, used to be our senator here. He spoke yesterday in India about the France Unity March. I want to play you some sound. After Kerry, you're going to hear White House spokesperson John Ernest sing a different tune. I want to play this for you and see what you think about it.
I really think, this is sort of quibbling a little bit in the sense that our Assistant Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, was there and marched. Our ambassador was there and marched. Many people from the embassy were there and marched.
There are those who are out there saying that the administration should have sent someone with a higher profile to participate in the march. I guess what I'm saying is that we agree that we should have sent someone with a higher profile.
Okay, it was Josh. My mistake. Anyway, what do you think of Josh and John, John King?
I think Josh is right, and Secretary Kerry is wrong. And I think, number one, Ambassador Nuland marched in Washington. She was not in France. The highest-ranking official, U.S. official, was our ambassador to France. And no offense to the ambassador, but just look at the pictures. You have, obviously the president of France, but you had the chancellor of Germany, you had the prime minister of Great Britain, you had Abbas and Netanyahu. Hard to get them into a room. They were about four people apart in the front of this line, along with other world leaders. Now, the White House argument is this came together pretty quickly, that it was originally a French event, and then it became a world event, and that they sort of dropped the ball on realizing how big it was turning into a global event. Okay, that can happen. But my question is that, to me, in an odd way, makes it a big. And what is your communication structure? A, Secretary Kerry's in charge of diplomacy. It's his job or someone under his under him job to say, we need to be here in a bigger way. And sending the president, probably too much of a security nightmare. The vice president, maybe, could have asked Bill or Hillary Clinton to go, could have put together a bipartisan congressional delegation. They could have acted quickly. And the fact that they didn't see this coming tells me, number one, that where's the communication? Where's the management structure? Why did no one at the State Department or no one on the National Security Council, as this evolved, say, hey, this is changing and we need to be a part of it because it's a big deal?
Well, first of all, until you said this a minute ago, John, I'm embarrassed to say when Kerry said that Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland, who no one ever heard of, was there, I assumed he meant along with Jane Hartley, the ambassador to France, she was there. You're saying she was marching in Washington, not in even in Paris?
She was back at a meeting in Washington, and there was a separate march here, and that's where my understanding is that's where she was.
Okay, so so they make a mistake, which we spent probably an hour talking about it yesterday and couldn't come up with a rationale as to how they dropped the ball. And then John Kerry drops the ball a second time, the morning after saying, you know, everybody's quibbling. And then it takes, what, another 8 hours for Josh Earnest, obviously on behalf of the president, to say a mea culpa, which almost never comes from a president of either party. Why did it take so long for them to, even after they made the mistake, to understand what a mistake it was?
Well, I'm going to say that I'm not going to blame Secretary Kerry, who was traveling in India. Once he made that decision, information gets a little distorted then. So if he didn't know exactly who was at which march, that doesn't bother me all that much. It's the fundamental decision that I think is the issue. For the White House to wake up on a Monday morning and say, you know what, we're going to acknowledge a mistake after pushing back during the weekend a bit, I actually think is pretty quick by Washington standards. Mm. And especially, you know, these guys in particular, no president, but these guys in particular are not known for coming out and saying we were wrong. And so, again, I give them credit. They blew this somehow. And I think that, number one, there's the slight to the French and the world, the world embarrassment that they have to deal with. But I do think there's a bigger issue here, and we've seen it on some other issues that I'm not going to equate this to any major policy issues they've had in the past. But again, the question that always comes up for me in any administration for these things is, when somebody, and maybe it was a kid, maybe it was somebody in the middle, maybe it was somebody on the top, didn't somebody start to see the email traffic that Yahoo's going to this, the boss is going to this, Circle's going to this? You know, I'm going to make a joke here and say they're listening to all these phone calls. They have to know these things are happening.
It's not a joke, John, but go ahead.
Well, all of a sudden, this, you know, I get the idea that all of a sudden this mushroomed into a global event, but I think we live in the United States of America. I think the idea is that we're supposed to be the world's leading superpower. Well, when it mushroomed, why didn't we know about it? Or if somebody did, what happened in the communications? I view this as this falls to Secretary Kerry and Susan Rice, because they are the CEOs of the sub-agencies, the State Department and the National Security Council, that should have gotten the president's attention and said, look, you know, we originally thought this was not a big deal. It is now. We've got to do something. I live in this town. There's a base called Andrews Air Force Base. That's where you see Air Force One.
Right.
They've got a fleet of planes out there that are used for all sorts of things, take people all around the world. They could have gassed up a jet and put somebody of a higher profile on it on short notice. And I get the security issues with the president completely. I get the security issues even with the vice president. They could have made this work. Eric Holder was in Paris. He was in meetings. He didn't even – if Eric Holder had stepped up in the front of that line, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation, or at least not as much. But somebody didn't get the right person, and that's you know, the president's the CEO, but somebody at the top level should have said, we need to change, and we need to change quickly, and gas up a jet and fix this.
Well, John King from CNN, obviously they blew this big time, and they're admitting they blew this big time. But let's put this in context. I mean, what is the context? This, I assume, is aberrational. Or maybe it isn't.
What do you mean aberrational?
That they don't usually make such a terrible mistake in terms of snubbing the French and looking foolish and
you
having
mean
all the other
tinnitus.
Yes,
mean.
And having all the other presidential candidates or would-be presidential candidates talk about what jerks they are, which is essentially what's going on. What's the context?
Well, I think there's a couple things in terms of our relationship with France. Secretary Kerry will apologize. Others will apologize. We'll move past. In terms of counterterrorism cooperation, but no, this is a public event. It is a demonstration. This is not, you know, they didn't miss a meeting at which war and peace were decided, but they did miss. Look, France is our first ally.
Yep.
France has been very helpful. And I know we have issues with the French sometimes. We did in the Iraq War, where the whole Freedom Front thing came from and things like that. But this president, remember, ran for president saying he was going to restore all these alliances and that working together was so important. They blew this one. Is there an operational impact? Is some, you know, something bad going to happen because they blew it? No, it's embarrassing.
Okay.
My structural question would be more, though, on the communications point. If I'm Secretary Kerry, we've had this conversation, and again, I'm not equating these things, but in terms of the management and communication structure, remember a year or two ago when we were talking about Benghazi, my question was not what happened on that day. It was why, after months and months of warning, did not somebody get to see Secretary Clinton and say, Madam Secretary, I think people aren't telling you things you need to know. We have a huge security issue here. The red light, the warning light, has been flashing repeatedly. It's like when your car is telling you you need to change the oil or your engine's about to fail. If you ignore it for 6 months, guess what? Your engine's going to fail. That's my question more. How, when you have these things happen? Now, in Benghazi, there were months and months of warning. So, again, I'm not equating them. But when this thing did change, how come that information did not get to the top, meaning Secretary Kerry, Susan Rice, maybe even the president? And if it – I believe it did. We have no evidence that it did. So why didn't it? If it did, well, then it's the CEOs made a bad call. They didn't change the plan. But my question is more the fact is, why didn't the information get there?
Hey, John, one last thing on this is I'm always curious to know how you called him the CEO or the president of the United States in this case, how people like Barack Obama deal with screw-ups like this. You mentioned that the people in charge of the sub-pieces were John Kerry, obviously Secretary of State, Susan Rice, National Security Advisor. Does he or somebody on his behalf dress them down for this? Is it ignored? Do they get yelled at? What happens in the Obama administration?
So in the past, I know that, you know, the president did voice exasperation, for example, when it turned out his chief of staff was told the Affordable Care Act website was not ready, and no one told the president, and they launched it. There was a dressing down in that case. I don't know the aftermath of this one, looking back and seeing exactly what happened. We'll find that out in the coming days and weeks, I'm sure. But I do know the president has, dressed people down in the past, saying, you need to tell me these things. The question is, do you get the structural improvement? And just the communication, the reason I think this is look, they made a mistake. I don't think there's any lasting impact on not showing up at the demonstration. But I do think my bigger question is, because of these things in the past, because of the Benghazi thing, because of the Affordable Care Act thing, if this information was in the system somewhere and it didn't get to somebody higher up, that tells me all their promises to improve lines of communication and command and control still have issues. That's more of my question. And again, I'm not trying to make a big – it's embarrassing on the diplomatic stage. I'm not going to do anything. But that would be my question more as a management. If I'm the president, I would be asking Dennis McDonough, my chief of staff, how high up did we know this thing had become a big deal? And where did it stop? And who decided we didn't have to change things? Those are the questions I'd be asking.
Okay, we're talking with CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. While we're on the theme of embarrassments for the Obama administration, there was another kind of weird juxtaposition where the president is giving a speech on cyber security, and meanwhile, some ISIS sympathizers are at work. Tell people about this one, John.
Well, ISIS sympathizers apparently hacked into Central Command, which is our military command that deals with the Middle East, and is dealing with ISIS right now. And they hacked into the YouTube account and the Twitter account. And the Pentagon insists they didn't get anything classified and that the stuff that they did find and post online has all been, published before. And so they say no operational, secrecy has been compromised here. No military, plans or weaponry or anything like that has been compromised here. But sure, it's embarrassing. It's a fact of life in the new age that whether we're talking about North Korea, whether we're talking about China, whether we're talking about ISIS, I think one of the things that makes this ISIS challenge interesting and so challenging is that they are so sophisticated in this part. They do, Al-Qaeda would pop up occasionally, the videos of al-Zawahiri, or in the old days, Osama bin Laden in a cave, and every 6 months a video would pop up or an audio tape. These guys, on a daily and hourly basis, are working social media to promote their own image, to recruit, and in some cases to embarrass like this. I think that is an added part of the fight here against ISIS, not just on the ground, but it's online.
Hey, John King, let's stay with the White House for a couple of minutes. I think it's today, it may be tomorrow, but you'll clarify for me. There's a big confab being called by the president with, 16 legislative leaders, a bipartisan thing. Whenever it's happening, today, tomorrow, what's on the table here? Are they trying to work out an immigration compromise? Is it about Keystone? What's the agenda and what's the hope?
It's all of the above. They want to talk about the early agenda in the new Congress. The president wants to talk about some things he wants, his new college tuition plan, his call yet again for an infrastructure bank, some of the other things he's talked about if you've watched him travel in the last week. The Republicans, they're going to try to change his mind about Keystone. The Republicans will talk about some other things they want to pass in the early days. And nothing will be accomplished, and nothing is accomplished when you have a big meeting like this. But that's not a reason not to have the meeting. If they can start to build relationships so that when you have the meetings that matter, which are going to be the small meetings between the president and just Speaker Boehner, or the president and just Leader McConnell, or the four where you bring down Pelosi, Reid, and Boehner and McConnell, that's where you're going to cut the deals down the road if there are going to be deals to be cut. Do I think that they're going to break any brand new ground in this meeting today? No, I don't. But do I think that breaking bread can help build relationships? I do, and so I would do these as often as possible, not looking for daily, results, but looking for over time relationship building. That said, the early days of this new Congress, even though the power structure in Washington has changed, it's exactly the same, whether it's from the leaders themselves or their staffs. I mean, if you guys could read my email, the back and forth sniping between Democratic staffers and the Republican staffers about every little thing.
Pathetic.
And here's what I think part of the problem is. These are all good people, and they work for their people, and they're trying to do their jobs as they're described by their principals. I've been here, going on 30 years. Most of these people aren't that old. They aren't 30 years old, or they're just barely that, and so they were in high school or college the last time Washington kind of worked. I don't think any of them remember a different kind of Washington. They don't know how to. It's almost not funny, Marjorie. They don't know how to behave differently, and that's a shame. It's been so long since Washington. You would have thought after the election that everybody would have said, "Look, we're not going to resolve anything, probably. But why don't we just calm down? Stop sending stupid tweets. Stop sending stupid emails. Stop saying things in public that are, just going to turn up the volume and turn up the heat. Just take a couple breaths for a few days and see what happens." See if anything can happen. See if anything changes. But they didn't even bother to try doing that. They just kept going at each other like they have been for years.
Hey, John, speaking of just occurred to me, somebody who probably wasn't alive the last time it worked, the brand new congressman from your former home state of Massachusetts, Seth Moulton, is getting rave reviews. Harvard grad, four-time Iraq veteran, and much to the amazement of many of us, got his wish and was given a seat on the Armed Services Committee, which I guess is pretty rare for such an important committee for a freshman. What's the word on the 35-year-old new congressman down there in Washington?
It's wait and see, just like I think it was when Elizabeth Warren first came here. Ed Markey, of course, was a known entity when he moved from the House to the Senate. But I do think, I often criticize people in leadership here. Remember, Nancy Pelosi decides who gets the committee spots in the end. And John Tierney was a friend of hers.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Seth Moulton got that committee, that's big of Nancy Pelosi.
That's a good point.
She could have said, "You beat my friend. I'm going to play small ball, and I'm going to put you on, the committee on widgets." Instead, she looked at his experience and said, "It's good for the Democratic Party to have this voice on that committee, and I'm not going to let the personal stuff get in the way." And that's big. And that's a sign of leadership. I think that there's too few signs of leadership in Washington, so when you see them, you should applaud them. Look, he's new here. He disagrees with his president's military policy when it comes to ISIS, at least in the details. He views it as a threat, wants to do something about it, but is skeptical about troops back in Iraq and places like that. Well, my attitude about guys like this is let them have a couple of months, to get comfortable in the committees, to get briefed up. And let's watch what happens. The test usually is that something you said in a campaign, no matter how good you are, something you said in a campaign, some position you took in a campaign, turns out either facts on the ground change or sometimes you were just wrong. And let's see what he says and does over the next couple of months and see where he stands up and says, you know what, as I've studied on this one, maybe the president's right, or maybe I need to move a little bit, or maybe here's where we could meet in the middle. Early reviews from the few people I've talked to about him particularly are very nice guy, seems to be doing it right as he gets settled in. We haven't had anything big happen yet, so we'll find out.
You know what I find fascinating about Seth Moulton, though? He seems so countercultural compared to most politicians that run today. He's not a big self-promoter. He's comes
across
as very humble.
Well, you should mention to John about that.
Okay. I'm about to mention to John, a very humble guy. And you may probably know this already, John, but if you don't, and if our listeners maybe have heard it, I'll repeat it because it's worth repeating. Walter Robinson, great reporter for the Boston Globe, goes to investigate Seth Moulton's war record and discovers that, in fact, there was nothing nefarious in there. He'd won all these awards for valor and bravery and all those sorts of things. Not only has Seth Moulton not mentioned them on the campaign trail, which is so bizarre for the typical politician, he hadn't even told his parents because he believed that it was unseemly to be, for the men and women that he lost and that it came back without limbs and so forth. He was not going to present himself as some sort of hero. And I heard that and my jaw dropped. That's unusual.
Well, God bless him. Look, I've only met him once or twice, and I met him when he was working for General Petraeus, back when I traveled to Iraq a couple times back in the day. He always struck me as somebody who was very straightforward. I don't know him well, and I don't want to claim to, but God bless him for that. And the humility, we could use a lot of that humility in Washington. That's a reflection of the military culture, that it's all team. It's not about any one person. You mentioned, I'm just going to work this in. In the first Gulf War, way back in the George H.W. Bush days, I spent a lot of time in Kuwait, in Saudi Arabia, with Walter Robinson. So if Robbie's listening, I miss Robbie.
Yeah, great reporter.
I'm glad to see he's coming to the movies.
he is, that's right.
Robbie puts the old in old school, and I don't mean that as an age thing. I just mean that as a credibility and a character.
Isn't Michael Keaton going to play him? The guy that just won the Birdman Awards, I think? Yeah.
Hey, John, since you mentioned him, it wasn't on our list, but very quickly, is David Petraeus going to get indicted? I mean, for those who don't know, there have been recommendations to the Justice Department that he be indicted for essentially disclosing classified information to the woman with whom he was having an affair and the woman who caused him to decide to resign as head of the CIA. What's the word on whether or not the Justice Department indicts the highest profile military person probably the last couple of decades?
My understanding is a lot of anguish in the Justice Department. You saw Dianne Feinstein, who's been critical of leaks and critical of the like, come out and say enough is enough. He's suffered enough. He's sort of been kicked out of Washington. He's lost his job. It's a tough call because, one of the criticisms of, never mind General Petraeus, one of the criticisms normally is that the little guys, get punished and thrown in jail, and the big guys somehow either get a good lawyer or have some in, and they don't get punished. And so on the one hand, you can make the argument that, he has to be punished. And you have a president and an attorney general saying, look what Edward Snowden did. He belongs behind bars. It's not the comparable, the scale of it, but sharing classified information is illegal. And so shouldn't General Petraeus be punished? He is a hero. He served his country for a long time, and he's made, apparently, if he's guilty of this, he's made a profound mistake. The question is, can they negotiate something here? And I assume that's the Justice Department's preference, is to negotiate something with General Petraeus so that they don't have to have a trial and they don't have to have, I would assume, they don't want to have prison time. But this is where it gets dicey in the sense that, your fame and your service should matter, but it doesn't completely wipe out the fact that the allegations here are quite serious about lawbreaking.
John, 1 minute on two high-profile people in the news this week. First one's Mitt Romney. Do you think he does it for a third time? What are your sources telling you?
That I did not. I thought at first this was sort of he thought that Jeb Bush hadn't placed the phone call or asked for the meeting to say, can we pass the torch and I want your guys to raise money for me. Will you come on board? And somehow this was, he just felt slighted. That's what I thought. But when you walk into a meeting and say, go tell your friends, and then they're making some calls, including the governor himself, Governor Romney's making some calls to key people around the country saying, I'm really thinking about this. I think until he dials back, we have to assume that he's really thinking about it. And you don't go from months of, no, that's silly, I'm not going to run again, to doing this. He cares about his own reputation. He's going out to the Republican National Committee meeting to speak to them. So I think he's giving it another serious look. And I think if he runs, he would be a huge factor in the race. We talk all the time about, the fight among conservatives to be the conservative candidate. Well, imagine if you had a big fight among establishment. If we had a Jeb Bush, a Mitt Romney, and maybe a Chris Christie, throw a Scott Walker and a John Kasich into the race. I love this. I think the more the merrier, not just as a political journalist. I think it's good for the party to have a big debate of ideas. But, boy, that would be unprecedented.
We're talking with John King from CNN. One more big story about a local person in the news this week is our own Senator Elizabeth Warren. As everybody knows by now, Antonio Weiss, big Wall Street executive, he was nominated to this high-level Treasury Department post, and Elizabeth Warren went ballistic and said, absolutely, this would be terrible, shows too much closeness between this guy and it'd be Wall Street in general and politicians and so forth. Well, he has he's withdrawn his selection. So how is this viewed? What are people saying about Elizabeth Warren? This is a victory for her, no matter how you look at it.
It is a victory for her, and it comes at a time when you also had – she gave a speech to a labor group the other day where she was talking about wages, and yes, economic statistics look better, but not if you work at Walmart. Some people took that as a shot at Hillary Clinton, who used to be on the Walmart board. You have all these people saying draft her, get her to run. I have zero indication that she's rethinking running. But we are in this remarkable Elizabeth Warren boomlet where, number one, she's proving she has juice on the Hill. She's proving when if she says, I don't want this person, a Democratic president lost a nominee over this. This is not her standing up to some Republican. This is a Democratic president who lost a nominee over a Democratic senator saying, I don't like this. So that's a if you're Hillary Clinton and you're going to run, even if Elizabeth Warren does not run, it tells you that if you say or do things or have people around you that she doesn't like, she can get attention. She can get media attention, but she can also get enough political attention to make a difference. So she's a factor. I see no evidence she's changing her mind about running. Hillary Clinton, I suppose, could surprise us and not run. But there is no question that it's hard to say this. I don't know. Again, this is no offense. That the senior senator from Massachusetts, even though she hasn't been here all that long, is growing in influence within the Democratic Party. Does that mean she can pass laws in the Senate? I don't know if God could pass a law in the Senate right now, the way it is structured. But there's no question she's growing in stature within the Democratic Party, and she's one of those people, she would hate this because, what is it, an old Merrill Lynch commercial. You know, when she speaks, people listen. I don't think she wants to be associated with sports Merrill Lynch. But when she speaks, people listen within the Democratic Party and inside Washington, without a doubt.
We're almost out of time here, John King, but it seems to me that she could possibly be much more effective for her cause, which is populism, income inequality, all these things, were she not president. I mean, obviously.
That's what she says.
Yeah, and I think she's right about this. She can keep speaking out. If she were running, she'd be co-opted in about 2 seconds like everybody else is who runs for president of the United States. Isn't that true, Jim Browning?
She has a platform, certainly, but in terms of she can speak about these issues, she can bring attention to these issues. Can she pass legislation on these issues? Is she going to reach some sort of peace with Mitch McConnell to pass things through a Republican Senate in the next 2 years? Maybe that will change after that. I think that will be the challenge.
Yeah.
No doubt she has a platform, but at what point does the frustration of trying to turn that platform into actual policy advances? I always joke, if you live in Washington, you want to get things done, it's like sticking your hand in a blender. How many times are you going to keep putting your hand in there before you realize?
I love that feeling.
I shouldn't keep laughing.
By the way, I'm not with Marjorie on this at all. My attitude is she is going to be putting her head in a blender for the next decade, and the place to go is the top job. But John, before we let you go, we know no one should call your house Saturday night, and for very good reason. You started this discussion here. Give us your preview of the road to the Super Bowl, please, Dorchester boy.
I'm just really encouraged. I barely exhaled after the Ravens game. That was way too close to the game, and getting down four. I hope getting down 14 points two times. We just got that out of our system, and that's not the plan. It's Sunday night, isn't it, Jim? Don't try to trick
me. Oh, is it Sunday night? Oh, it is Sunday. Oh, my apologies. Yeah.
Look, I just, you know, as Peyton Manning has left the stage, I think that we watched that one, and I think Tom Brady inside, I'm not saying this is his last rodeo. I think he wants to stay around for a few more rodeos. But you see a focus and a temperament there that he knows he's not going to get that many more chances at this, and he seems rather possessed at the moment, and I like that.
Okay, John King.
Good luck, John. That's what...
Good luck Sunday night. Be on your game.
Talk to you Tuesday, John. Okay. Thanks.
John King is CNN's chief national correspondent.
Love when he says we.
He joins us every... I know it.
Like a kid. It's so great.
I know. Yeah, I know. You can catch him on Sunday mornings at 8:30 for Inside Politics. Okay, coming up, the world is celebrating the journalists at Charlie Hebdo as martyrs, really, on behalf of freedom of expression. But how far can we go? And should we exercise those rights in the United States? Does political correctness cast a shadow of censorship in the United States of America? We're going to ask you next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. In the aftermath of the Paris terrorist attacks, the world has been celebrating the journalists at Charlie Hebdo, Je suis Charlie, you've heard that a lot, as martyrs on behalf of freedom of expression. But how much are we really free to express here? Think about your own life for this discussion, in the classroom, the college campus, the workplace, even your book club. How easy is it to get penalized for expressing yourself honestly? How many times have public figures had to apologize for just speaking their mind? Do you think freedom of speech is alive and well in the United States in 2015? Or do you find that you're often censoring your own words so you don't outrage someone or ousted yourself for having a dissenting point of view? Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. We both have a Smith College connection. Marjorie went there for a couple of years. My daughter is about to graduate in May. So can we start with a Kevin Cullen reference
outrageous.
To what happened at Smith
outrageous.
Recently? Go ahead, Marjorie.
Well, Kathleen McCartney, who's the president of Smith College, she was moderating this panel discussion, and she was talking about the fine surroundings of the Smith College Club in New York City. And she said, as Cullen reports, obviously she was kidding. We're just wild and crazy, aren't we? Well, the word crazy was censored from the transcript, replaced with the term, quote, ableist slur, unquote. That's how far they took the situation up at Smith College. And he doesn't say, but I assume this is in that this was some sort of – if the transcript was official Smith or not official Smith, or it was a student newspaper or whatever, but they could not cope with the word crazy. And there are a million examples of this. David Brooks wrote about the same situation in the New York Times when he talked about people overreacting to campus microaggressions. And by the way, this is one of Harvey Silverglade's favorite subjects, the local lawyer.
Shadow University.
Entire books about this. Brooks cites the University of Illinois, which fired a professor who taught the Roman Catholic view on homosexuality. The University of Kansas suspended a professor for writing a harsh tweet against the NRA. Vanderbilt University de-recognized a Christian group on campus because they insisted that they wanted to be led by Christians. And more closer to home, we had Hershey Alley. She's the Somali-born woman that was extremely critical of Islam, who was disinvited disinvited from Brandeis University. I'm 90% sure. I should double check that, but I think.
But it's not
Brandeis
just
University
we're all we're focusing you and I on your. It's not just universities. As I said in the opening of this thing. How many people don't say at work what's on their mind because they're worried there's going to be blowback from political correctness? So this and James Risen, remember we introduced interviewed James Risen from the New York Times,
yep.
Who was essentially prosecuted by the Obama administration. They finally dropped this thing. But we've had people in here who are respected leaders who say that no one has been more of an opponent of free speech and journalistic freedom than in terms of presidents, than Barack Obama. It's not just the Edward Snowdens and not just the James Risens. It's the prosecution and surveillance of federal workers, whistleblowers, et cetera. So what we want to know, and again, you don't have to think about the big picture, you know, again, the university scene, but in your own life, do you feel we have freedom of expression in the way that we're attempting to celebrate it in the wake of this these killings over there in France? I think the pieces by Cullen and Brooks, if you haven't read them yet, are right on. They are perfect.
We've got another more great examples from both of them. We'll share with you in a minute. But, you know, I this is Emily Rooney from hostess emeritus, I guess we call her, of Greater Boston, still host of Beat the Press, and she's with us every Friday on Emily's List. She talks about the riding out of town on a rail urge that we have around here in Boston. I think we have it in the whole country. That someone says something and it's off color, or they tell a bad joke, or they make some sexist remark, or even a racist remark, and right away they are labeled as a gross sexist, a terrible racist. Now, they might be, but it's gotten to the point that we jump to conclusions and we do ride people out of town on a rail. They lose their jobs. They lose their whatever without really looking into what as well as you can, what kind of person they are. It's like they have known by the worst mistake they ever made. I think we're very, very quick to judge on those kinds of things. We call people racist all the time. And some of them are, but some of them aren't.
Well, also, you're talking about people who do say things that draw criticism. How about the vast, I think, majority of people who don't say things that matter to them because they're worried about what the reaction is going to be? There is a son of a very good friend of mine goes to one of the finest liberal arts institutions in the world. And all he does with dramatic examples is complain about the level of intolerance. And he doesn't mean just from officialdom at the university. He means from his fellow students.
Right.
If you dare to say something that is not so ultimately and totally politically correct, you, as you mentioned a minute ago, you're the source of great derision. And so the only reason we're really talking about this, because the topic is not new here, the reason it's made new or at least refreshed is because of this universal celebration of freedom of expression in the wake of the killings over there in France. Our number is 877-301-8970. What's your take on this? And also, have you experienced personally a situation in which you believe your freedom of expression has been inhibited for fear of what the consequences are going
to
be?
There's one more great anecdote I want to share. Smith College seems to be leading the charge on intolerance here because Wendy Kaminer, who's a brilliant Boston-based lawyer
and great
social critic and very well-known, written tons of stuff and very smart, she was on this panel up at Smith talking about she was pointing at the absurdity of euphemism, like the N-word. And instead of – she said the N-word, and then she actually said the word itself. And – pointing out that when she said the word, nothing happened. Well, she was immediately labeled a racist, and she was called all these terrible names. And I thought it was totally unfair. She was making a point and using the word and kind of accused in some quarters up at Smith College of of being horrible.
Wait, and by the way, the one little piece in the middle of that story to add to it is her view is there anybody, when you say the N-word, who doesn't think of the actual word? So what are you achieving? And then she goes and says it and says, as Marjorie said a minute ago, nothing happened. The world didn't end. And so, and her point was not to just gratuitously issue the word. Her point was to make a point. 877-301-8970. But the interesting thing is constitutional lawyer turned president of the United States, in the minds of many people whom we both respect, is as intolerant of freedom of expression, despite the ultimate fade on the James Risen situation, one of the most prominent journalists in the United States of America, of any administration. So we want to get your thoughts. But by the way, the more grounded they are, meaning the more they're your personal experiences, your office, your friends, your book club, whatever, the more interesting they might be. Marie, you're in Marlboro. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for the call. Hi.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for taking the call.
Thank you.
I've been listening to you guys for quite a while now, and I've been here about 20 years, and you can never say what you're thinking to anyone in this country without the fear of upsetting someone. Now, on my for my behalf, I don't really pander to that too much. I figure I am who I am, and this is who you get, and so people know where to stand with me, but you're always on your toes around here.
And it's different in Ireland? Is that what you're saying?
But it is, because we don't care if we upset you, because there's no point in hiding who you are or what you're thinking, because it's going to come out at the end of the day anyway, whether it's around the dinner table or after a few jars at the bar.
You know, I mean, that is a great question, too. Are we better off by constantly guarding what we're saying, or are we better off, like Marie says, around at the pub, you know, just kind of letting it all hang out and let the chips fall?
Well, how can you argue? I'm sorry, go ahead, Marie.
No, look, I don't think you can argue that you're better off hiding it. I mean, I worked in the place for many years, and everybody knew where they stood with me, and we had an issue where we kept losing staff. And they came up and they said, well, I questioned someone one day, I'm like, why are you quitting? And they said, because of the person at the desk. And when I brought it to her attention, she said, well, I don't understand why. She said, you're the one that's straight out with everything. And I said, yeah, but at the start of everything, you're the nice one, and then when you turn on them, they're not expecting it. There's no question about where to stand with me.
Hey, Marie, you said it beautifully. Thank you. And you can say what's ever on your mind anytime you want to call here. Thanks for the call. 877-301-8970. Haven't you censored yourself a million times?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah. I think you're – because you see what happens to other people who are not – I mean, I think the Sony example was a classic example. The people that were head of Sony said really bad things about implying that all Barack Obama wanted to do was go see movies about black people. And they were
– Oh, you mean in the emails. Oh, I'm sorry.
The emails,
okay, yeah.
And they were outed for that. And what was everybody calling them? Big racists.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe they are big racists, but maybe they were just making a stupid joke between two close friends, as husbands make stupid jokes to wives, as two co-workers make a stupid joke. Maybe they'll say about somebody's really looking, you know, hot today or whatever in their outfit. But if you were to say that too loud and someone overheard you, you would be hauled into human resources as being some terrible sexist dog.
Well, but you would, I understand, everything should be in context. And you're right. We shouldn't judge the, whatever she is, the co-head of Sony and the guy with whom she was emailing.
Well, I think you were judging her, Jim.
I was just about to say, but I do judge her. Those were pretty horrible things.
They were horrible.
She has the right to say them. And if she wants to say them. Now, by the way, they were private emails and I'm not pro-hacking. But she did say them. She's not denying them. They're pretty bad.
But does that mean she wants to subjugate African Americans?
I didn't say that.
What is being a racist?
The content. I didn't say call her a racist either. I said the content of what she said is troubling. If it turns out that's what she believes and she wants to say them, that's perfectly fine. Of course, their position was, as you say, it's a bad joke. So she got to explain herself after the fact. 877-301-8970.
I think you were ready to ride her out of town on the rail, Jim. I think you're reassessing things.
Really? But then I saw the interview, as I said to Jared, as you hear a little later, and one of the finest movies I have not really ever seen.
Okay, John from Somerville. What do you think, John?
Hello, John.
Hi, Marjorie and Jim. Great discussion.
Thank you.
I wish I could speak in an Irish brogue like Marie. It would make everything I have to say more endearing.
That's probably true, John. Go ahead.
So my comment is that this clearly was an assault on free speech, what happened in France, free speech and expression. What bothers me is that everyone's been calling the staff members, the victims that were killed at Charlie Hebdo, journalists.
Mm-hmm.
And they are not. They are satirists. They are
That's true.
Comedians. And what it does, though, is it undermines and compromises the work that journalists around the world are doing in some of these dangerous situations. Journalists go in and do their work with an unbiased and neutral position, whereas these people clearly were editorializing. And I just want to make it clear that there is a distinction there that I don't think is being drawn. It's calling them journalists is like calling the staff at Mad Magazine or The Onion.
Yeah, but John, I have to disagree with you on that.
I've heard a lot of people call them cartoonists.
I don't think that your distinction between someone who's got an opinion and someone who writes impartially is totally fair. That's number one. What troubled me much more than what troubled you, John, and Marjorie and I discussed this with Charlie Sennett yesterday, is how many full of themselves real journalists, in quote, in this country were acting as if they were at personal risk in the way that these people were over there. The most of us have the security of our studios and are not at risk of anything except being fired someday for giving in crappy performances. But that was one of the – when everybody jumped on the bandwagon and said essentially we are them, not in empathy but to sort of celebrate our own work, that frankly troubled me more. But, John, thank you for your call. And by the way, as you said yesterday, these cartoons, putting aside the journalist versus editorialist thing, the cartoons, for the most part, are foul. But that's really not the issue, is it?
That is not the issue. That is not the issue. By the way, there's something called the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, or FIRE. Harvey Silverglade, local Boston lawyer, writes about these people all the time, just surveyed 437 colleges and universities and found that more than 55% have codes that prohibit speech protected by the First Amendment. Apparently, the number of schools who maintain speech codes has declined slightly, but it's still pretty huge. This is from Kevin Collins' column in The Globe.
And by the way, something else worth reading, and we're going to continue this discussion, is the Muzzle Awards. Remember they started at the Boston Phoenix when it existed, and Peter Kadzis was the editor. Well, Peter Kadzis now works at WGBH, luckily for us. And his colleague, Dan Kennedy, who you see on Friday nights with Emily and is also at Northeastern and now has a GBH connection in addition to that, the Muzzle 16th Annual Muzzle Awards, well, I guess it's now, well, yeah, 17 now. The Muzzle Awards are now here at GBH. I would Google them. They tell you a lot about the lack of freedom of speech in certain sectors in our society.
Okay, we're going to keep going in this conversation until the top of the hour. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. Again, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about freedom of speech, reassessing, I guess you could say, how free we really are here, now that the price and privilege of freedom of expression has been put on the national, international stage in the aftermath of last week's fatal shootings at Charlie Hebdo. In a recent piece that we mentioned, Globe columnist Kevin Cullen points out the foundation, Marjorie mentioned this, Foundation
did,
for Individual Rights and Education surveyed 400 colleges, 55%. It's 55% have codes that prohibit speech protected by the First Amendment. We want to know in your everyday life, not just grands, in your everyday life, do you feel that you have an exercise freedom of speech, or do you feel inhibited and that you got to pay a price if you choose to be free? The number is 877-301-8970. I'll point out before we get back to the calls, and this is obviously Silverglade, you said it much more brilliantly than I ever could. The ultimate irony is what is supposed to be the marketplace of the freest exchange of ideas are college campuses, and it's the place where there are the greatest inhibitions. It is obscene.
Yeah.
877-301-8970.
Partly, of course, is because 18-year-olds can be so myopic. You know, they're,
what do you mean?
Well, everyone's 100% right or 100% wrong. You know what I mean? There's not a lot of – teenagers are very, very judgmental, it seems to me, having raised a few. Anyway, let's go to a different John from Somerville. What do you think about free speech, John?
Hey, John.
Hey, guys. I just had two quick points that I wanted to make. And the first was that I think it's important to distinguish between social censorship and government censorship.
Yeah.
Like, I think freedom of speech is alive and well in this country, but I don't think it's a terrible burden that I have, of course, censored myself in social situations. It's not, you know, that I don't want to offend anyone isn't such a great penalty to pay for such a for a tolerant and multicultural society. You know, Jim was right about the Sony emails, or I can't remember what you were saying. I mean, they have the right to say what they want to say, but everyone else has the right to judge them for it and say,
sure,
well, that's racist. And the second point is, I think what's more scary about for free speech, from my perspective, is not the proliferation of hate speech codes on college campuses, although I agree that's scary, but that, I don't know if you've heard about the programs at, I think it's being piloted at Rutgers, where there are policies now that if a student is going to be made uncomfortable by something they would have to watch or read for a class, they can be exempted from having to do it. And I think the reason that, for me, this is a free speech issue is that we are becoming a society, I think, where because we have so much choice in how we spend our time and who we listen to and all of this, we feel like we should not ever have to be offended, that we should never have to be uncomfortable. But the problem is, if your university is doing its job, it should be making you uncomfortable. And that's the importance of free speech. We should have to be uncomfortable some of the time and deal with those ideas.
John, that was a brilliant
phone call. That was a brilliant call. The trigger, are you talking about those trigger watch things?
Trigger alerts.
Yeah, trigger warnings.
Well, that's what that thing, by the way, that ableist slur that you read about when the president of Smith had the temerity to use that, we're just wild and crazy, aren't we? They deleted crazy from the transcript and said ableist slur, but it was preceded by a so-called trigger warning because it might be upsetting
people.
Well, I
mean, the most obvious thing to say at this point is that if you are so fragile that you're going to be sent over the edge despite the history you may have had with some sort of violence or some sort of awful thing by reading about it in a book, I think it may be difficult for you to cope with your life going forward. And you need to teach people some kind of resilience. You know what I mean?
You know what John said before? Campuses, you should be made to feel uncomfortable because that's this critical time when you're hopefully start critical thinking. But the point he also made about the Sony situation was far better than the point that I made about it, which is, if you say things and you're willing to express yourself freely and honestly, sometimes there are consequences. That's what comes with freedom of expression. Freedom of expression doesn't mean you're free to say what you want and no one else is free to criticize you. They're free to criticize you. And if it turns out you don't like the branding that you're taking, as you say, it was unfair to brand these people racist without knowing much more about them, and I agree with you, what they said was racist doesn't mean they're racist. Them's the breaks, then don't say it. But if you do say it, you know there may be a price. You know what it's like? It's like those people, we had this debate in the studio about a month ago, I guess, when the students at Harvard and Georgetown and other places were saying exempt us from the exams, were too upset about this thing. What was your reaction to that?
I'm not sure what story you're talking about.
You know, all those people said we want out of our exams because of how upset we are about the Ferguson
thing. I thought
it
was ridiculous.
Well, there's more to the story. But okay, we'll get back to it some other time. Let's go to Alma.
What was more of the story?
We are huge in Somerville today, apparently. Alma, you're in Somerville. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Alma.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for making it.
There's so many points to comment. Quickly, what in the beginning you talked about, we do self-censor, I think, because certain people, news organizations, have learned that if they scream long and loud enough about something, they can bully people into stopping saying something. Or they can make something up like the war on Christmas. But my other point is, it works because they get attention.
That's a good one. By the way, we plead guilty to that. We've played along. We at least had that discussion in the past. But now we're chasing by you,
big
Alma.
Big investigations when the little green elves were banned from some elementary school in Western Massachusetts.
Alma's disgusted with us. I don't blame her. Go ahead, Alma.
I'm kidding.
Go ahead.
My bigger point is that I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know all the details, but I don't think that censorship, in the Smith College case, is a violation of free speech because they're a private institution. Now, maybe Rutgers, because it's a state university, maybe that's a more free speech.
No, by the way, let me be clear. You're right. We're not arguing that there's a violation of the Constitution. We're talking about free speech, lower F, lower S, not a violation of the First Amendment.
Then I think. Because that's what people are saying. Oh, it's a violation of my First Amendment rights. And I don't think it is at all. But I think you've made folks have made one of the best points is that we want to stand up and say something and maybe rile people up, but we don't want to face any consequences.
Yeah. That was John's point.
That's another issue that could deal with the whole thing about doing things and getting away with it without paying a price.
Alma, thank you. And that was the point I was trying to make that you were made. When we were talking about the Georgetown and Harvard Law School people, is it's fine if you don't want to take your exam, if you want to protest, et cetera. There are consequences for your behavior. You have to live with the consequences.
Well, I think also there's sort of a victim nation thing going on here too, where everybody wants to be part of a victim class. And I shouldn't say everybody, but some people do, and so that they get very upset about these slights, which you want to try to learn to cope with in your life.
You know, one of the reasons reasons why Chris Christie is both reviled and beloved by many people is because he says there's no filter on this guy. How many times have you seen the YouTube videos of him completely eviscerating a teacher, a veteran, somebody who crossed him? Now, I know you're really turned off by that.
I hate them.
A lot of people love it. And you know why? Because I'm not defending it. I'm just explaining it. They say, well, even if you don't like the way he behaves, even if you don't like his language, he's not playing games. He's saying and acting exactly as he feels, as opposed to all these other phonies who are policing their own speech and behavior. There's some appeal I have. There's some appeal, even though there's a power differential between a governor, obviously, and one of his or her constituents.
Well, because politicians are probably the most careful of anybody not to offend anybody about anything. Scott from Boston. Scotland from Boston. Hi, Scotland.
Hey there.
Hi, how are you today? And thank you for having us on the program. It's a great conversation.
Well, thank you.
You know, it's interesting that the point that you brought up about Chris Christie, and it makes a very important point. And I have I'm at odds with the previous caller who commented on the lack of journalism or lack of being a journalist for Mad magazines. Mm-hmm. Satire magazines and other publications have played a key role historically in addressing some very, very important social and political issues around the world, not only in this country, but in other countries. And so I would say that you can't necessarily state as to whether or not you're a journalist as to the validity or the importance of the dialogue and the important discourse that occurs.
So Scotland, we only have 30 seconds. I don't mean to be rude, but I just want to alert you.
Nope, that's great. And then I think the other point is that we've got to remember that we lose a lot of opportunity in our political discourse and understanding when we don't have an intellectual conversation about such important issues such as this. So
I agree. Scotland, well said. Thank you for the call. Sorry we had to cut you off.
And sorry we didn't get the rest of the calls and the emails. We're up against the clock. Coming up, Police Commissioner Bill Evans joins us. We'll get his take on the challenges the police force could face if the Olympics come to town. That and more is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Kick off the noon hour of today's BPR with the Boston Police Commissioner, William Evans. He'll take your questions and ours on post-Ferguson and Staten Island fallout, the Paris effect, and keeping Boston safe during a possible Olympics.
New Governor Charlie Baker talks a good game about closing the achievement and fixing the schools K-12 all around Massachusetts. How's he going to do that? We're going to ask our education expert. Then lots of us talk a good game, too, about how we're going to ditch the dreary office culture and work in blissful freedom from home. We'll get from you the pros and cons of working in your pajamas. And finally, Jared Bowen, WGBH Arts Editor, on the latest in stage and screen all around the city. All this coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So joining us in Studio 3, as he does every month, to take our questions and yours, is Boston Police Commissioner William Evans. We are told he just returned from some special secret training in Florida. We're going to get to the bottom of that, despite what Commissioner Evans would like to keep to himself. Commissioner Evans, it's very good to see you.
Thanks for having me on, Jim.
Pleasure.
Really? Some secret training in Florida?
Yes, yes.
What was that about, please, Commissioner?
No. You know, I'm obviously a runner, and I went down to Orlando on Saturday. I got there around noon, and I ran the Walt Disney Marathon on Sunday morning.
How fast?
Well, I did in 3:42, and that's like six or seven stops to get my picture with the character. So I did pretty good. You know what I mean? And if you go on the Disney website, you'll see me with Mickey, Aladdin, and all. Like, I stopped six or seven times. So overall, you know, when I looked at the results, out of 20,000, I finished 825. So
that's
I did pretty
excellent.
Good.
Yeah. Wait a minute. So you're actually running through the Enchanted Village yeah. with all the rides?
Well, you go through all five parks, and they have characters lined up on the side. You can run over and get your picture taken, and Disney sends them. So I was looking
that's
at
hysterical.
Them pretty good. They came out pretty good. So I was running for the, you know, Martin Richard.
MRE.
I didn't know that.
I got the shirt on. And
yeah,
so.
Martin Richards, the 8-year-old boy who was killed in the marathon. Yeah.
Oh,
his sister lost
so
her leg, family injured. Yeah. From
so
Dorchester.
It was a fun event. And, you know, I had never done that one. That was my 48th marathon. So, you know, I enjoy it. And I was back on a plane in the afternoon to come home. So a quick 24-hour junket down there.
You see, if we two were running 48 marathons, Jim, then our shirt collars would be a little bit too big for us. Like the commissioner's too big for him.
Obviously, I got to tighten this up. So.
Okay.
So, Commissioner, in the last, a lot of news in the last week or two, most current is, as you know, I guess it was last Thursday, was it? Whatever day it was, Boston was picked by the United States Olympic Committee to – oh, and by the way, the commissioner is taking your calls. I should have said that. 877-301-8978. Anything you want to discuss with the commissioner of the Boston Police, you are welcome to. Olympics, the U.S. Olympic Committee picked Boston to be the United States representative. We'll know in 2017 if we get the Olympics. But part of the responsibility, I assume, is to begin planning for security issues. What's your part in this, and what does this mean?
Well, you know, it's obviously a huge undertaking. You know, when we had the Democratic National Convention, I was part of that planning and making that a successful event. So it's of the magnitude of something like that, probably even bigger. So, you know, most likely Homeland Security will make this a special security event where Secret Service will take over the lead of it. And, you know, we'll work closely with the Secret Service, FBI, state, and all our partners to make sure the Olympics are a great event in the city.
Why shouldn't that concern us? Why shouldn't when Secret Service, FBI, Homeland Security take over security in our town, your town, for an event? Why you're the person right. who is directly responsible to the people of Boston and right. obviously surrounding communities coming into Boston? Why shouldn't that concern us?
I think you know any event now. Unfortunately, the world we've come to live in. You know, there's an increased security threat. We've seen what happened in Paris. We've seen what happened with our marathon. So, you know, obviously, such a high-profile event like the Olympics, or even last year's marathon, you know, we basically have to make sure people feel secure, whether they're coming from all over the world, all over the nation, that people can come here, enjoy the games, both as spectators, as participants. So,
yeah, but do you worry about somebody looking over your shoulder? I mean, you are the top cop. I don't mean this facetiously. Yeah. Obviously, in Boston, and you've worked for decades to get there. How do you feel about some Fed looking over your shoulder?
I don't mind. I mean, for the most part, you know, last marathon, we work with the Feds. We work with Secret Service. All hands were on deck to make that. But most of the time, Jim, and we work all the time with the Secret Service. We've had more presidential visits over the last 20 years with Bush, Clinton, President Obama. They're a great agency to work with. We work with the, you know, the SAC here. You know, they're great to work with. So, you know, I'm sure they'll let us run the show and they'll work behind the scenes. And that's the way it's always been.
You know, one of the things, Commissioner Evans, it was in a piece from The Guardian, which is kind of critical of Boston. Basically, they were saying that one of the reasons we may be attractive for the Olympics is because while many people would think we did a great job in the marathon, other people would think, well, there are people that were, you know, in this lockdown in their homes in Boston while they're looking for the younger Sonayev brother in the Watertown situation. And critical of the DNC, the convention 2004, which I remember being at, we talk a lot about police going out looking in their uniforms, like Mike is in over there, not looking like a scary person.
He looks pretty scary to me, by the way.
He looks very nice. He looks very nice. But I remember being at the convention and police, Boston police, remember we came out of the convention?
I do remember, they were
in riot gear. And then they had the protesters were in those cages. And it was weird to me. They were cages and I think they had netting over the top of them right. so they couldn't get out and stuff like that. I didn't think, due respect, that we looked very friendly, the police department in Boston. It was 11 years ago, but
right.
still.
But I think, Marjorie, we've learned a lot. I think, you know, the approach we've been using lately is a softer approach. I think you've seen the marathon last
yes,
April.
Yes, very different.
And the biggest thing I wanted was to people to come And that marathon looked like it always was, which is a family-friendly environment. We had some tactical assets, but they were all out of sight, so nobody could see it. I understand, you know, people's perception of coming in, it shouldn't look like an armed camp. And back when the DNC was going on, I think there was a different mentality of putting the guys out there with the helmets and sticks.
Yeah.
But throughout these protests, dealing with Black Lives Matters, we had a protest last night, about 40 or 50 people walking around the city. We've been very low-key. You know, we're not going to have that type of presence out there. We've learned, again, if you come looking like you want to fight, then you're going to get a fight. So I think we've shown and learned that the softer approach works better. If things go a little out of whack, then we have troops ready to move in with the equipment if need be.
And in fairness, that was not that long after 9/11, obviously, the 2004 convention. Our number is 877-301-8970. If you have questions for Commissioner Bill Evans, who's going to be with us for at least another 25 minutes or so, 877-301-8970. We've got Anthony in the car. Anthony, thanks for calling.
Hi, Anthony.
Hi, Jim, Marjorie, and Commissioner Evans. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to commend Commissioner Evans on the conduct of the police during the Eric Garner protest. I was actually a student who attended one of those protests, and I called into you guys talking about the issues associated with that last time we spoke on air about it. So for one, I wanted to commend him on that. And I was wondering where he's at with the status of body cameras for cops in Boston, if there's any plans for pilot programs with body cameras, or if you can give us any updates about that situation.
Anthony, thanks for the call. What is this? We've talked to you a lot about this body camera thing. Where are things today?
I mean, me and the mayor are looking at it. We're dealing right now with, you know, the protests going on, and we understand, there's nationwide, there's basically a cry for them. We're looking at the pros and the cons right now, Jim. You know, if you put the body cameras on, again, there's a lot of unknowns out there. When do you have the cameras on? We go into a lot of people's homes, you know, domestic calls, sexual assault calls, and, to go behind people's doors and have cameras on and then get snapshots of things that maybe somehow can be used against those parties later. You know, there's no case law on what the parameters are of using them. So, you know, we haven't ruled it out, Anthony, but there's still a lot of unknowns out there. I think initial results have shown that complaints against officers have gone down. So I see the benefits of it, but it's still in its infancy stage. And so we're just looking at the pros and cons, and we're not against it by any means, but I got to tell you, the verdict's still out on the pros and cons.
Well, two things, Commissioner, if I can. And by the way, if you want to speak to the commissioner, the number is 877-301-8970. Is it fair to say that you and the mayor are more open to the question than you were when the debate started? Is that a fair statement?
It's a fair statement.
And secondly, the stuff that I've read, and I admit this is not conclusive, it's all fairly new, is the data so far is pretty powerfully suggesting it de-escalates situations. And again, I think the concerns you raise about privacy are totally legitimate, that I assume you, the mayor, city council, whomever, would address. But the data seems to show that it does reduce the tension between police officers and the public. Now, is that's also a fair statement?
Well, I read one study in California, and I think pretty much, Jim, that's about the only one I've seen.
Okay.
So, if we look at how many departments have it now, I'd be interested in 6 months what the additional study said, because all I've seen is one study out right now. But, again, I'm all for it. It's just a matter also of the costs, the storage. It's an enormous amount of people power in monitoring the cameras as well as the costs. But, if we see more studies but clearly right now it's something we're looking at.
We're talking to Police Commissioner Bill Evans, who joins us every month. This is a great story by Nestor Ramos in the Boston Globe yesterday, talking about this beanbag, police officers firing small beanbags at this gentleman who turned on every burner on his gas stove and threatened to blow up his triple-decker in Dorchester Saturday night, and police were there. Tell us about these beanbag shotguns. Never heard of this.
No, we've had them for some time, Marjorie.
Really?
And we've used them. It's a non-lethal, less lethal weapon that we have. And our sergeants are trained, and they're well qualified in their use. And it's for a situation that possibly that we could use lethal force. Clearly, this individual was intoxicated.
Yeah.
He had some mental issues. He weighed, I think, 290 pounds. He was 6'3".
Wow.
You know, he had put all the gas on in his house, was threatening his mother, who was unfortunately locked in a room. And, you know, very dangerous situation. But the officers who respond were quick to sort of contain the situation, call for a lieutenant and a sergeant, and they quickly went down there with this. And rather than use, you know, a regular gun, and we're unfortunately, you know, trained that if we're going to shoot, we use deadly force. And in this particular case, they used a bandbag, and the family was thrilled that although they thought, you know, we had every right to shoot, to kill there, that we chose the, you know, the more soft approach. And so it's an effective tool. We use it on pit bulls, dangerous dogs.
Really?
Yeah.
Let me ask you a dumb question. Are these little teeny tiny bean bags, or is it a big end of the gun?
No, it's bean bags that
tiny. And they fit out down the nozzle?
Are they carried by, when you mentioned a sergeant in that situation, are they always carried as an alternative?
The sergeants have them.
They have them all the time, wherever they are.
If they don't have them in the cruiser, they'll have them in, at the desk, and they'll run back and get them and bring them. So most of the, a lot of them carry them with them all the time. So, you know, if you get into a situation where we have, obviously, someone mentally deranged, and this poor kid had a history of pulling knives and was very violent. So it's nice that we can come out of that with a positive result.
So if you get hit with a barrage of beanbags, what happens to you?
It can be initial, like a jolt, and you might get some bruising.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's like anything. Heaven forbid you hit someone in the eye with it.
Okay.
There could be danger to the eye. Or, you know, I think I read in the paper that once someone got hit right in the chest and they died. But for the most part, most of all the studies done say, except some bruising, it sort of momentarily immobilizes you.
Immobilizes you. So you're
puts
knocked
you down.
Over. Okay, okay.
But, you know, mostly, you know, I think the poor kid went to the hospital, didn't even really have to be treated for it other than his mental issue. So, again, you know, we have some non-lethal tools such as pepper spray and that. You know, we've never gone to tasers. We've never gone to any other type of devices, and in this case, it was an excellent use of restraint by our officers, by our supervisors, and the family was thrilled that we chose that route.
We're talking to Commissioner William Evans of the Boston Police Department. He spends time with us every month quite kindly. Let's go to Allison and Lynn. You're on with Commissioner Evans. Hi there, Allison.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. How are you all?
We're good. Thanks for the call.
Great. Thank you.
So, Commissioner, I'm just curious, and I realize that there is a certain brotherhood within, but what is your reaction about the behavior of the New York City Police Department regarding the new mayor there and how they've not just turned their backs, but the symbolic aspects of it, the behavior, the misconceptions, and all of that? How do you take that?
Well,
what's your perception on that?
My perception is, you know, it's a very emotional time for those officers. You know, they lost two of their brother officers. You know, there was a lot of negativity towards police in general. We are feeling it here in Boston. We're feeling it across the nation. And some of it might be justified, but unfortunately, everybody's bearing the brunt of what happened in Ferguson and what happened in New York. And, you know, I know the mayor had said some things that touched a raw nerve with the officers that they believed brought up the tension to the point where this person who obviously had some mental issues took it out on two young officers with families. And so, you know, I think if he was more supportive of the police when this event had, not that I'm not saying the guy and the officers were right there, but I think they felt that he abandoned the police department in favor of you know, this whole incident, which was ugly. And, you know, I wish that whole incident could have been more transparent. The grand jury proceedings were more transparent. That was ugly. I'm not going to get here and say those cops were wrong, or I'm not going to say, you know. But I think if people heard what the grand jury listened to, but I think the mayor was quick to jump on the bandwagon against the cops. So I think he could have done a better job of staying out of it. So, you know, whether they turn their back or not, emotionally, I think they're all hurting. And hopefully, you know, they can mend fences because, you know, what's going on in Paris, what's going across the nation, now's not a time for us to be playing games with national security.
Allison, thank you for the call. You know, relevant to that conversation, the Fraternal Order of Police, the national entity, is lobbying Congress to get added to hate crime legislation any assault on a police officer. Is that a good idea?
Any assault on a police officer?
Any assault on a police officer would, in addition to the crime that currently exists, would be considered a hate crime under federal legislation.
I think if they look like there was a motivation behind it.
Because they were a cop, meaning.
Because they were a cop, yeah. Right. I mean, we unfortunately get into domestics all the time. We get into mental, dealing with mental people some days. And we're in barroom fights. So basic assaults, no. But clearly, if we are targeted because of what our profession is, I'm all for it.
Understood.
We're talking with Commissioner, Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans. Our number is 877-301-8897 if you'd like to speak to him. You just mentioned, Commissioner, that police officers are still sort of paying the price of what happened in Ferguson and what happened with Eric Garner in Staten Island in New York. What's it been like in Boston? There was a protest, 40, 50 people on the Black Lives Matter thing just last night. Are police still bearing that brunt in Boston?
We are, you know. What does that mean? I mean, the sad thing is we were out there last night and, you know, they marched from Tremont Street down by the Garden. And, you know, again, a lot of negativity being thrown at my offices, you know.
Calling names, that
names,
kind of stuff?
Names. And, we had some minorities screaming at our minority officers that they were traitors. And so a lot of ugliness is still going on. And Marjorie, you know, I think everyone realizes this was a wake-up call for police across the country. I think Boston here, we got a great relationship with our community. And honestly, I wish the dialogue now would go to the violence that happens every day on the streets of the city. You know, Christmas Day, you know, I was home. I got a call for a young kid shot on Humboldt Avenue. I was out there on Christmas Day. Christmas night, three other people were shot. I didn't get one phone call from anyone over what happened on Christmas Day. Three or four nights ago, we were all out 0 degrees on Harrisoff Street, four people shot. There's no outcry about young black kids getting shot every day in the street. And I wish they could sort of push all this energy, not only at us, but also at the senseless violence that goes on the street every day.
When a police officer is walking down the street and someone yells at him some racial slur or you're a traitor or whatever it is, what are police supposed to do? Say nothing? Or what's the training?
Well, our training is basically we have a, you know, we do roll calls. We tell them, we tell them people are going to try to agitate us. You know, stand tall. Don't let it bother you. And for the most part, Marjorie, we've had about, you know, probably 10 protests now. And the officers have done a tremendous job, tremendous restraint, and I think we're getting a lot of rave reviews. And that's why I'm saying, you know, I know, you know, there might be a march this Monday I'm hearing on Martin Luther King Day. We're all for the protesting. All we ask is, you know, they do it respectfully, they do it peacefully, and they're not disrupting traffic. I know the public's starting to get real fed up at us that we're not doing more. And so, you know, I think everybody's got their point. Like the mayor says, it's time to engage in a dialogue, find out what we can do better. But I think I'd love to see more people paying attention, and let's scream and yell about the violence that goes on in our cities across this nation every day.
We're talking with Police Commissioner Bill Evans. He's with us until for another 15 minutes at least. So if you want to call him, now's your chance, 877-301-8970 or bpr@wgbh.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We are joined, as we are every month, by the Boston Police Commissioner, Bill Evans. He's here to take our questions, your calls, at 877-301-8970. Commissioner, before we go back to the calls, Mayor Walsh, is tonight? Yeah, it is tonight.
Yeah.
State of the city. What's he saying about the cops?
Well, I think he knows we've done a real good job last year trying to address the violence the best we can. I think he's happy with the way the protests have gone there. He realizes the restraint. But again, we're not satisfied, Jim. We lost 53 people to homicides this year. And me and the mayor, our motto is one death's way too many. So the good thing is, you know, we had 35 less shootings than we did last year. We took 1,061 guns off the street. So
how much from the buyback? How much of that is?
I think about 400 okay. from the buyback. Yeah. So that's 700 guns that our officers have been running down, chasing kids, getting guns off their waistband. And honestly, no officer involved shooting with anyone who has had a gun. So it shows the amount of strain. So I think he knows how hard we're working, how well we do at community policing, and all the great events we do in the neighborhood every day that the public doesn't know about.
But he's not announcing some new initiative as to the police department that you're aware of, is he?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. 877-301-8970. Actually, Russell is in Providence, Rhode Island. You're next on Boston Public Radio with the commissioner of the Boston Police Department. Hi, Russell.
Good afternoon, Commissioner.
Hi, Russell.
I primarily wanted to speak about professionalism in police departments.
Yeah.
One of my biggest concerns is, for example, I didn't think that anything the mayor of New York said was really all that offensive. In fact, it'd be awesome if someone could find the exact quote and we hear how offensive or not it really was. But for the officers to turn their backs, to me, shows that they don't want any kind of oversight. And I find that really disturbing. If you watch the Eric Garner video, the officer used a chokehold that went against NYPD policy. And I don't know how many other jobs where you can violate company policy that results in someone's death and you still keep your job. So if there really are only a few bad cops and most of them are good, what is Boston doing to get rid of those few bad cops and not let them continue to break the rules and put citizens at risk?
Russell, thank you, Russell, for the call.
Yeah,
Commissioner.
I mean, we have a very good, obviously anti-corruption and internal affairs unit that we're very transparent. You know, we do early intervention programs where if we see an officer having several complaints, we intervene. We get them some counseling and whatnot. So we have a very active internal affairs investigation unit that you can go online, you can come into a station, we take phone calls, and we don't get a whole lot of complaints about conduct out in the street. But, you know, as far as getting back to the New York incident, again, I'm not saying those officers were right by any means, but I think the tone that the mayor had set after that wasn't really a big pro-police. And, you know, he sort of, from what I heard, he sort of was not back in his department. And it was very emotional. I think if you lost two of your colleagues and your boss wasn't standing behind you, I think, it's a natural reaction.
Chokeholds, I assume, have been outlawed in this department for a while.
They are.
Let's stay in New York City for 1 second. The two things that at least Lynch, the guy who runs the police union there, was particularly perturbed about, and I think a lot of his members, is one was some comments supportive of protests post-Ferguson, post-Garner in Staten Island. But the second thing, you and I discussed this last night on television, was the mayor, he's in a biracial family, his wife is black, telling his kid that he should be careful, essentially warning him about police. Let's bring it closer to home. I understand he's a mayor, so it's a different situation. He's got a different platform. But in light of history in this country and some history in this town, is that the wrong thing for a parent of a black kid or a Latino kid to be telling his son? Or is that the wrong thing to be doing?
Well, you know, again, Jim, here in the city, I think we've built a lot of respect and a lot of trust here. I mean, we're in every school. We're in every neighborhood center. We've given out more toys over the Christmas season. We have great interactions with the kid out there. So I hate to hear that young kids, and we're in the schools, we're trying to build the trust. So I would be a little upset if someone's telling their kids here in the city that they have to watch out for
the
police.
How about in that city, based on
the
history?
Well, yeah, again, I don't know. I know since de Blasio, Mayor de Blasio's got in there, you know, he's abandoned the stop and frisk policy, which, you know, clearly it sounds that that they had to tone it down. And I've worked with Jeff Fagan and Anthony Braga, and Jeff Fagan sort of—
They're the ones who did the report,
did our
right?
report here, and he said, obviously, there was a problem there. And I think, you know, the mayor abandoned that. But, you know, to go public with that, I think it's one thing to say to your kid, but I think the way he went public with that sort of said, you know, don't trust the NYPD, which is a slap in the face to them. Maybe you can say it to your kid, but I think him going public showed that he had no confidence in his department. And so I think that's the quote. When you tell someone to watch out for your police department, there was some distrust there. And hopefully, again, they can they can bury the hatchet on that. And
you know, speaking of your community, every time you're here, you talk about sensitivity training, community connection. Ryan posts on Facebook, whenever you highlight the differences to you, differences between the BPD and other departments embroiled in scandals, you mentioned sensitivity training that new officers receive now in the academy. Do veteran officers receive any ongoing training as a regular part of being a police officer? If so, what portion of the training, et cetera, is in the areas of community policing versus training for use of surveillance or weapons or that right. sort of thing?
We do ongoing training. Again, our academy does a great job. Unlike a lot of academies, Jim, and I think I've talked to it, we bring in all kinds of groups. So yeah. Our officers have a great understanding. You know, we got Mona Lisa Smith from Mothers in Justice and Inequality who comes and talks. She's a mother of a victim of a homicide, her son. She comes in and explains to basically to our academy class what it is a mother's going through. You know, NAACP comes in. GBLT, gay, lesbian, they come in. And we'll keep operating more and more groups. And, you know, we're trying to get more of the veteran officers into in-service training so they also get it. But, you know, we want our officers to come out more as community people, not as a military force. We want to be problem solvers where arrest isn't the only solution. And I think Lisa Holmes, who's an African-American superintendent running the academy, she's doing a great job. In fact, you know, if I can give a plug right now, we have a upcoming entrance exam for the Boston Police Department in April. And so if anyone's out there and knows of anyone who wants to join the force, especially young African-American males, Vietnamese, you know, I encourage them all to please go online. You can sign up online because the more candidates we get, the more diverse we can be.
I like that a woman's running the academy there. Yeah. That's pretty neat, yeah. too. Bobby from Rockland, thank you for calling. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, Bobby. You're on with the commissioner.
Yeah. Hi, commissioner. How are you doing?
Very good, Bob.
That's good. I'm retired from one of the local departments next to Boston, so glad to be retired. Don't miss it at all. But anyway.
I'm looking forward to it.
Anyway, on the night of the Christmas tree lighting, my sister, who's retired, she's in her 60s. She was a college teacher. She keeps us one night a week over in Cambridge gig where she teaches a course and makes a little running around money. Well, to come back into Boston, where she lives, she came down to Leverett Circle, and that was, unfortunately, they had a die-in going on. She was in her car, which was a two-week-old car, and she got stuck in the car. The protesters ran up the line of cars out of Leverett Circle. They pounced on her car. They hit her cars with signs. She ended up with a car 2 weeks old with smudges and scratches and little dings all over it. There was about 30 police officers there, combined state troopers and Boston cops, and not one of them did a thing. She said most of them didn't even unfold their arms. I think that's a disgrace. I mean, the people, honest people are out there trying to make a living and to protect these rights of freedom of speech for protesters. Police officers are now ordered to stand by and do nothing while other people's rights and property are being damaged.
Bobby, we hear you. No, we hear you. That you're saying they're being ordered. Let's hear what the commissioner is telling them to do or not do in these circumstances.
One of the things I clearly say when we begin this and the supervisors is we won't tolerate any type acts of vandalism, any disruptive, any assault on the officer, any violence at all. I apologize if... you know, that's the first I've heard of anyone's car getting vandalized to that extent. But one of the main things we give out in our orders is, hey, use a lot of restraint, but we will not tolerate anyone breaking a window or causing anyone's damage to any properties. For the most part, all the demonstrations we have, we really haven't had any reports of anything really being vandalized. So, you know, make sure, you know, if that happened to a car, she lets us know about it. But for the most part, it's a delicate balance here. You know, if we start dragging people in and it gets, basically more antagonistic, then, you know, then we have other issues and we tie up officers for hours and hours. But for the most part, all these protests have been peaceful with very, very little damage. So, you know, we walk a fine line, but we won't tolerate anybody getting assaulted or any vandalism to anyone's property.
Bobby, thank you for the call. Phil, Facebook posting. What do you think, Commissioner, of your staff when they park in the handicapped spots or the bus stop in front of the Dorchester Court? This is a Marjorie issue, too, even though she's not Phil. It happens in capital letters all the time, says Phil, and frankly, parking isn't that much of a problem there.
Yeah, I don't tolerate it. I mean, you know, we're no better than anyone else. So if that's happening, please make sure you call the local station. You know, we've had those issues in the past. You know, I hope it's not Boston. As you know, there's all kinds of different agencies that are coming, but no one should tolerate anybody parking illegally. And if that's happening, we need to know about it, get the license plate, and please call it into us.
You know, I parked in a fire lane for like 30 seconds.
Yeah, that's what he said, 30 seconds.
About 20 years ago.
I don't believe it.
Literally 20 seconds. My flashing lights were on, and Marjorie continues to bring it up for 20 years. Isn't there a statute of limitations on that or no?
Marcy Boulevard, too.
It was Marcy
Boulevard. It was Marcy Boulevard.
Excuse me, it was Marcy.
I love bringing up that incident, Jim.
Jim's had a lot of run-ins on Marcy Boulevard. You know, our producer just said, and this is a great question related to parking, the south end of Boston, you know, which has become quite an expensive area of Boston, unlike South Boston, which is still in transition, getting more expensive, but not quite up to the South End. In South Boston, forever, we have these space savers. I think the mayor allows them on the streets for 48 hours, the kitty litter boxes and the diaper bags and all this kind of stuff. The South End says no space savers. Where are you on space savers? Are you entitled to keep them if you shovel for three hours?
You hit one of my pet peeves.
Okay.
You know, I've lived in South Boston all my life.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's terrible over there. I mean, I know it's a tradition over there, but I got to tell you a secret. When I'm out jogging at 4:45 in the morning, I'm throwing a lot of space savers out of there, you know, and I'm always afraid I'm going to get caught. But, you know, when it's not even snowing, people have out space savers. And after 5 days of snow, they still have them out. So, you know, I know it's a touchy thing, and I've lived over, and it's gotten worse to the point where it's not even snowing. And people put out these. And, you know, I'm running at 4:45 in the morning, and someone has it in there who's never even come home for the night. So, you know, it's a touchy with me, a touchy subject.
Apparently it is.
I'm not a big safe, saver spot. But it's
dog
a way.
Eat dog to park your car in South Boston, I think.
Now, there are two police officers with you here. If you can just motion with your heads, is it legal for the police, either shake your heads up and down or negatively, for the police commissioner to unilaterally take the property of other people, use the space savers, and dispose? They're both shaking their heads.
Only after the 48 hours, Jim, before it snows.
Why don't you make a citizen's arrest, Jim? You know,
no, I'm just asking, you know, and they apparently are.
Although, by the way, the double parking I've seen by police officers and stuff like that is not in Dorchester. I've seen it in South Boston.
A double
right
parking by policemen?
Once or twice.
You better stay out of South Boston.
Hey, Mr. Commissioner, there was a piece by Todd Wallach in the Globe the other day. I'll read you the first line. It was actually a couple of weeks ago. Two specialists in the state's public records law say the Boston Police Department is violating the statute, public records statute, by refusing to release the names of five officers who were caught driving drunk. I don't want you to play lawyer, Why aren't we get the article makes the point that if someone's arrested for drunk driving as a civilian, that's up on the website, why shouldn't the public know who these officers are?
I think they should, don't Jim? You know, I don't think we're any better than anyone. I think the case here was it was a year, 2 years after, when that more has to do with Corey and the request of information. I think as soon as after the incident happens, we always release the reports. And I know I spoke to the media afterwards, and I said, you know what, it wasn't worth making a big stink of it. We should have just released the names. So I think in the future, you know, I got nothing to hide. If our officers are wrong, they're wrong, Jim. And, you know, I think, our media was just basically going on being stringent on what the law says. And that's like, if you're going to request names of anyone locked up, we just can't release that information. But in the future, I think, for all the bad publicity we got in not being transparent, I think clearly, I've talked to Michaels here, that won't happen again.
You know, speaking of releasing names and transparency, you mentioned when we began this discussion with you, Commissioner, that you had just come back from running a marathon with Dopey and Mopey and the Seven Dwarfs and all that down. And are you going to put any of those pictures up on the Boston Police website so we can see you posing?
We'll see. I like the fact I ran with MR8, and that's a great organization. You know, I know, they'll have a team for this year's Boston Marathon. And, you know, I was supposed to go down to New York and run with them, but Mayor Menino passed away, and so I missed running for their association here. So I was proud to run the Walt Disney Marathon for their young son. You know?
They're a phenomenal
family. Yeah, and it's going to be a tough time for them with the trial coming up, and the sight of their son, you know, in Calm for Peace and everything else is something I think we'll all still live with.
You know, before you go, only have a minute left. You've been doing this a year and a week. I mean, this is a dream. You're a Boston kid. You were a cop. How many years were you a cop?
32.
Ooh, 32. What's this been like? I mean, what's it like for you?
I like it. You know, it's never.
How stressful is this?
Well, that's why I have to go to Disney to run a
marathon. It is, isn't it?
It's the, and people say, why do you run? I says, because that's the only time I'm really not on my phone. It's the only time I sort of get to unravel a little bit. But it's been a tough job. And what's tough for me, Jim, more than anything now is I know how hard our men and women work every day. Mm-hmm. I know how what great relationships we have. And unfortunately, there's a lot of anti-police sentiment out there towards us that I don't think is called for because, you know, every life matters to us every day. We work tremendously hard, and I hate to see that people are anti-Boston police because our hearts and soul go into this community to make sure every young kid's safe, no one gets injured, and me and Mayor Walsh work hard every day to make this city the best place it can possibly be. So that's the frustrating part. None of us mind working hard, but I just wish the public would realize and respect us more given what's happened other places. That's not us.
Commissioner, pleasure as always, and we'll see you next month.
Thank you very much for coming in, Commissioner. Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans joins us every month to take your calls and our questions. Commissioner Evans, again, thank you for being here.
Before he comes back, we should do a little research on this unilateral removal of the Space Savers by the Commissioner.
I think so.
Consult
some
civil liberties lawyers and see what's going on.
You can jog right behind him tomorrow morning.
I just do enforcement. That's enforcement.
Okay.
Take
coming
care,
up, earlier we were asking you about freedom of speech. Now we're going to ask you about freedom from the office. When you opt to be a freelancer or work at home, are there things about the office you miss? How about all those reams of paper? Or do you like working in your PJs? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And as much as you think you dread coming to the office each day, have you ever experienced the setback of not working at one? Have you felt isolated? Do you feel disoriented without that demarcation of work and home? There's this new article, it's great actually, in New York Magazine. Writer Jennifer Senior, I think that's her name, defends the office, writing that it's called an ode to the office, but ode to the cubicle, I think she calls it, writing that it's where you can be social and creative and that it beats working alone or from a coffee shop. Apparently, 40% of the workforce will soon be working outside of an office. And is there something to say about the old-fashioned workplace? Our number is 877-301-8970. In addition to the fact that 40% now will soon be working out of the office, Marjorie, apparently it'll be a majority of Americans by 2030. In a recent poll I saw, 2 out of 3 Americans want out of the office and want the freedom. I did too. I've told you this before. Biggest mistake of my whole life. I became a consultant for a couple of years. Essentially, I set up office right outside the refrigerator in my house and ate my way through 2 years of consultancy. No discipline, no structure, no social contact. Yeah. So in the abstract, it is wildly appealing. But I have to say, coming to the office and having this is a huge – I mean, if you obviously hate the people you work with and hate your job, it's a whole separate thing. But given that things are tolerable, if not better in most circumstances, I am a pro-office voter.
Well, I think it's nice to have sort of a happy medium where you might spend a day or two in the office and then 3 days at home because it is so great. I am much more disciplined than you, and I do work from home.
I know you write a lot from home.
In my second job, you get home, you can get comfortable, you can really not have everybody interrupting you at work all the time. You can really sit down and think and shut off the phone and just concentrate and get a lot of work done. I think I can get a lot more work done at home than I can at the office. I wouldn't want to be there all the time. I mean, you miss kind of your camaraderie, you know, shooting the breeze and catching up in the office gossip and stuff like that. But I think the wave of the future, and it's interesting, you hear a lot of young people talking about this when they're looking for businesses they're going to go into, they like the opportunity to work at least a day or sometimes 2 days from home.
But what was the context in which it was? I'm so embarrassed. Was it just yesterday? It was yesterday. We were talking about social isolation. What were we talking about? Oh, about email. We were talking about,
right.
I mean, that's the same. That is the major problem, I think, is I understand you write better when you're by yourself, but why are you making a face at me? Socialize, it is a real problem when there's not human contact.
I think
my only contact was with like a cheeseburger.
I mean, I think, you know, you're describing yourself, Jim, as a man who has to check his emails 200 times a day.
I do.
And set up his office in front of the refrigerator and is eating all day.
Not by choice.
You know, there might be a little bit of a discipline issue going on there.
No, I know. But I by the way, I'm not praising my behavior. I'm just saying I didn't have the discipline to do that. And what I also realized, I mean, the socialization deal is a huge part of your work life.
But you know what else?
And also a huge source. And you know, one of the weird things is, you worked with some great people at the Hurl. I know some very close friends, some really capable people. Didn't you get great ideas just from hanging out and talking to them?
Yes, you do. But
and don't we get great ideas in the newsroom up here on the second floor?
But oftentimes when I was still at the Herald, and I'm no longer, I'm at the Boston Globe's website called cruxnow.com, in case you want to check it out,
C-R-U-X,
that's right. A lot of times when I really need to think, I would take my stuff and go into this room and be by myself so I would not be interrupted. I can't stand being interrupted when I'm trying to think. Maybe that's just a fault of mine, but I can't operate that way. I just don't think you want to be there by yourself all the time. But you know what the other great thing is?
Ode to the cubicle. I love this. But go ahead.
As long as your kids aren't little, I mean, if they're 2 years old, you can't get anything done. But if your kids are older, it makes your life so much easier because you can put the roast chicken on at 1 o'clock and have it be done at 6 o'clock. And you can throw in a load of laundry and go back to your work. And you can move it from the washing machine to the dryer. All those things that you need to do as a working mother, you can do at home and still get your work done and not have the stress of having to do everything at 7 o'clock at night, which is really hard on people.
Yeah, it's an eloquent defense of working out of the office, I should say. Really, no, it is. I really mean it. Let's start in Rhode Island. A lot of calls from Rhode Island today. John, you were on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hi there, John.
Hey, how are you?
We're excellent. Thank you. Hi.
Hey, I've worked in an office, and right now I'm currently freelancing. I'm about 26, and I think part of it is, you know, the grass is always greener argument. You know, when you have that office job, you're like, oh, if only I could freelance. And then once you have that freedom, I think part of it is also, at least with my generation, is kind of the generation of instant gratification and, you know, attention span of, you know, goldfish, just like, oh, I'm at home. I can do work when I want. I'm going to go on Facebook. I'm going to go on Instagram. Right. I'm going to do whatever I want. But aside from that, the thing that gets me the most working at home that I don't like is at work, you have work stresses. At home, you have home stresses. And when you work from home, they sort of just all ball up together. And you sort of have mental associations with certain rooms in your house. And you're like, oh, I don't want to go in there right now. You know, that's my office, you know. So it's kind of hard to separate that sometimes.
That's a great call. That is a great call. John, thank you for making. You know what I also realized when John was talking? I don't know why I made this association. You know what you miss when you work at home? The supply closet or the supply drawer. Is there a joy when you open that drawer upstairs and you see all those pads,
those notebooks,
and those pens?
All those pens.
No, I'm serious about
that.
All that
computer paper.
Is there not a thing? Do you not get a little bit of a thrill out of that?
It's very exciting to see the computer paper. Jim, I say that every day.
No,
I walk by that drawer and I just get a little twinge.
What if you need a pen, Marjorie? And instead of finding one pen in your house, you pull open the drawer, you find hundreds.
No, that's true.
Is that great?
That's true. But you take things from the office.
No, I do not. I did many years ago.
No, but that's okay.
Oh, you do.
If you're going to do work for the radio, I mean, I think it's okay to take home notebooks.
A pad or two, sure.
Yeah, I think so. I hope so, because I've been doing it. Okay, let's go to A. Lee in Somerville. What do you think, A. Lee?
Hey there.
Hi. So I'm a science journalist, and I recently went freelance, and I work from home. And one thing I didn't think that I would miss from work is heat. And I'm not talking about the warmth of my colleagues. I mean physical heat.
Yeah.
In this weather, you know, and I've got I don't have the kind of thing where I can just heat my office. I'm heating my entire home.
Yeah, that's true.
And I've been trying to do the math and figure out, should I just go to coffee shops and buy a coffee every hour? Would that actually be cheaper than trying to heat my home and
great
my office?
Great point.
No, that is a great point. You do have to. I mean, especially if you don't have the zoned heating, which most of us don't. You do spend a lot of money on heating the house.
So how's the math worked out, Ailey? What's the deal?
I mean, it's a little back of the envelope right now, but I mean, especially if you factor in the cost, you know, the cost of making coffee, I think it might even just be better to go to my local coffee shop.
Ailey, thank you for the call. By the way, I love working at a coffee shop.
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah.
No, I don't.
But I know people that just absolutely do, that will take their computers and they'll hang out at Starbucks for 3 and 4 hours.
It does aggravate you, though, when you can't get a seat. But if you do get a seat, it is a great – I love it.
Half the time you go into Starbucks now, people like snoring in those overstuffed chairs and stuff like that. And their coffee is almost as cold as it is outside.
Do you believe – you know, I guess this is not surprising. And this statistic I want to read again, I think it's from the piece that was in New York Magazine, but if not, something else you read this morning. By 2030, which is just right around the corner, it'll be 6 years after the Boston Olympics – the majority of Americans will have gotten what they're asking for. A majority of Americans will not work in an office. I guess that's not so surprising.
You know, the bad thing
telecommuting is, and all that sort of thing.
As everybody says, that your work time gets all messed up because
what do you mean?
Well, you could, of course, you know, once you're finished dinner and helping the kids with the homework, whatever, you can go right back to work because you're right there. So you can be working until midnight from home.
My issue was exactly the opposite. I understand that's a danger. My issue was any distraction I could pop, and I'm a fairly disciplined person. Every single reaction from food to the radio to cleaning up to what every distraction that was available I took.
Amy says, one of the things I enjoy about working from home is that she can listen to NPR all day long. Thank you very much, Amy, because, of course, we are the local NPR station.
You listen to work, too.
But she said it's that's a very good point. But she said it's isolating for her tastes, so she likes to go into work unless it's like a blizzard.
Okay, let's go to Liz, who is in a car. Liz, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Jim and Roger. How are you doing?
We're excellent. Thank you.
Great.
So I'm doing pretty well right now because I'm so I used to work in an office and then I worked from home. And now I quit that job after a year and a half. And now I am actually sort of like a road warrior, which is a third type of experience. So I'm between clients right now. I go into clients' homes. I just got a nice coffee. I'm listening to you guys, listening to you every day on my lunch break. So that's kind of nice. You know, I'm not working from home, so I'm not totally active, but I'm not in an office either.
What do you do when you go into people's homes?
Exactly.
Ransack them? What do you do?
I actually do one-on-one ADA therapy with kids with autism.
Oh, good
really?
For you.
Wow. Wow.
So, cool, you know?
So how weird is that, though? How weird is that, having a different workplace with every client? Is that hard?
I mean, you get used to it, and it's funny because I like the dynamic situation that, you know, you're always somewhere different. There's always a change of scenery and there's always something interesting going on, you know. So I have a little home office at home where I do all my paperwork, and we have an office that we go to, you know, if we need to have meetings or whatever. But it's kind of nice. People who have like left and said, you know, I hate being on the road all the time, have actually like come back and they're like, I hated being stuck in an office all day.
Yeah,
but you know what? The weird thing is whether you said you've done both prior to this road warrior thing, as you described,
yep.
Liz. But the one similarity between home and office work, maybe the only one, is that you get comfortable with the same surroundings. It's like, for example, when my computer is not working at one of the two places mm-hmm. I work and I have to sit at someone else's desk, everything else is the same and I have access to all my stuff, but I don't feel comfortable. You know what I mean? Because it's sort of not my spot. So I actually admire your flexibility and ability to do what you do elsewhere. But it's really hard, I think. But
Liz,
in any case, Liz, thanks for the call.
I don't know. I think it's kind of – one of my good friends is a nurse for the VA, and she travels around to people, gives home care to veterans. And the great thing is, you know, you need to stop off at Roach Brothers and pick up some food, or you need to stop at CVS and get whatever. You know, you can
– you're allowed to leave the building when you work at a place too, Margaret.
I know, but that's a big production.
Don't you find great comfort in your – like when you get to your desk upstairs, we sit next to each other in a little cubicle. Well, it's not a cube. I don't know what it is. A little something.
I don't know what it is.
With Chelsea.
It's a quadrant,
a pod.
Isn't it?
Thank you, Chelsea.
It's a pod.
Chelsea is our pod mate.
We're three of us
together with our colleagues, one pod or a pod and a half away. Don't you find comfort in your pod? I mean, when you get to that spot, I'm sorry, but when you get to your spot in the morning and you see Chelsea sitting where she's supposed to be, I am sitting where I'm supposed to be. You're in last of the three of us, of course.
Of course.
And I'm serious.
No, I don't, actually, because you and Chelsea are always whispering to each other, and I can't hear what you're saying. I don't know if you're talking about me or if it's something I should know. I feel like, am I going deaf? Why are they in such...
No, I'm serious. I am serious about this. There is a certain comfort level that allows me to do what I do better than I would do it otherwise because of familiar surroundings. Whether the little bit I worked at home, which was not a wild success, obviously, but it was okay. In any case, so let's move on. Let's go to, speaking of home, let's go to Cambridge, where Tom is on Boston Public Radio. Tom, thank you much for the call. Hi.
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 I worked for 30 years in the corporate environment.
Yeah.
I retired 2 years ago. The last 10 years doing a lot of telecommuting. Until the end of that 10-year period, I was full-time telecommuting. And what I found that I missed in the office environment was the opportunity to walk down the aisle and go sit with a colleague, socialize a little bit, and then get business done.
Yeah.
It's huge.
That's true. That's a big one. You are lonely a lot if you're home
all
the time.
Well, Tom is lonely? Oh, you mean one is lonely.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's great.
Being at home didn't really offer that, you know, you could talk to people on the phone, but it didn't offer the opportunity to work socially.
I think it's right. And by the way, beyond the fact that it's very comforting for most people, assuming you like the people with whom you work, as I said before, think of the number of good ideas, even if it's little pieces, little slants on things we're talking about on the radio, things you're writing about for your for the Globe website, things. There's that cross-fertilization thing, if that's the proper terminology. I agree with you, Tom. I missed it, too, when I was doing the home thing, and it's hard.
Wasn't that the Marissa Meyer argument when she made all the everybody come back to work at Yahoo?
The creativity thing?
Yeah, the creativity thing. You needed to be there to kind of share ideas and sit around.
But doesn't that make sense?
No,
I mean, think about our news. I mean, think about meetings we have upstairs, news meeting, whatever.
Uh-huh.
That's. I mean, there's a lot of what we do ends up popping out of those discussions.
Pops right out.
It does. Okay.
Let's go to Donna from Worcester. Hi.
This is really a hopeless conversation.
Hi, Donna. I work from home. I've worked from home for 14 years.
Yep.
Prior to that, I did work in an office. And I have no problem focusing on my work and getting it done. And I agree with what Marjorie said. I can pop in laundry. I can get dinner started. And I can. I have two kids, so I can run them around and get back to work if I need to.
How old are the kids? How old are the kids?
10 and 14.
But aren't they also a problem? I mean, while you can take care of them and get them around or whatever you just described, isn't it a problem having a 10 and a 14-year-old hanging around while you're trying to do your job?
No, because they've been used to it. That's the way they grew up. So know I have my office, and if my office door is closed, don't bother me.
You know,
if it's open, you can come in.
Donna, I was at this this alumni meeting the other night where this woman was talking about starting her own business where she was going to shuttle around kids in the afternoon, kids your age exactly, because mom is at work, dad is at work, there's no one there to drive them. It's a real pain in the neck. You don't know if you can depend on the neighbor next door to do it. That was going to be your whole business, to be home, to be able to take the kid to the soccer practice or the dentist or whatever.
I think that would be great because I don't know how other parents do it. That's what I'm able to do. And, you know, I had conversation with somebody the other day exactly that. How do people get their kid to soccer practice at 4 o'clock in the afternoon?
Well, it's really hard. A lot of times they have to lie. They have to, you know, they're sneaking out to go to the dentist and actually they're going to a soccer game or whatever. You can also go to the soccer games. I mean, I think it's just it's a very liberating thing. And you can work again at night. And by the way, if your kids, 10 and 14, need help with their homework, they can ask you because you're right there.
Every time you talk about the soccer games for your kids, the story you tell is you go to watch your kid play soccer. Your youngest daughter was a great player and scored like almost all the goals from the team. Did you ever see a goal?
Well, I saw a few.
Did you ever see a goal?
I saw a few. But people,
what do you do when you go to soccer games?
People can relate to this. Soccer, you know, there's not that many goals that are scored. So you're talking to the other parents on the sidelines and you get wrapped up in this conversation and all of a sudden your kid has scored a goal.
Do you lie?
And that was the debate. Do you lie and say...
What did you do?
Well... A couple of times, actually, I did.
And what if she said to you, what did you like about that particular goal?
I would try to get the lowdown because I thought it would break her heart to know that I'd been talking to, you know, Nancy while she scored the goal. I didn't see it, particularly when she was little.
So one last thing here before we leave this.
I shouldn't have lied.
We had a colleague at the other radio station, Jay Severin, who did all of his broadcasting on an ISDN line from his house.
Right.
If you could do this from your house, would you do this?
No.
Why?
Because I want to have a job that I come to. I mean, I have two jobs.
One you do at home.
If I would not want to do it full time, I want to come in and shoot the breeze and gossip mostly, which you can't really do at home.
It's all about the gossip with Marjorie. If you don't know Marjorie, it really is. Did I miss anything?
That's right. Okay.
What did she do?
I think everybody's pretty enthusiastic about working from home, Jim, and you're the only one that's sitting in front of the refrigerator with their desk right there. Coming up, we're going to look at the state of education and what challenges the new governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker, faces and what opportunities he has to make a difference. Education, that is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Massachusetts is positioned for some major changes in education. We have a new governor, a new secretary of education, and Mayor Walsh is narrowing his search for the city's next superintendent. With this convergence, what are the opportunities and potential pitfalls that await us? Joining us for his take on this is Paul Revel. Paul is the Francis Keppel Professor of Practice of Educational Policy and Administration at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education. He's also the director of the Education Redesign Lab. He's the former Secretary of Education serving the Patrick administration. Governor Weld also appointed him to the Board of Ed. Finally, hello, Paul Revel. How are you?
Hello, Jim, Marjorie. Nice to be here.
Thank you very much for coming in. So as you know, Paul, Governor Baker, I forgot who the governor was for a second there. Governor Baker's talked about, you know, closing the achievement gap, improving K-12,
right,
strengthening voc ed, and all these things. We're going to get to those specifics in a minute. But do you think that he is going to be able to do these things?
Well, I think he'll make a run at it. He's somebody who's cared deeply about education for a long time. And so I know he thinks it's important to the economic development of the Commonwealth. He's got huge challenges, number one being the budget. He's dealing with a budget deficit, as you know, in this current year, so going to have to make some 9C cuts. And then looking in the long term, some of the things that need to be done in education are going to cost money. Not everything that you want to do in education necessarily costs money, but some of the important things, for example, in early childhood or in higher education are going to cost some money, and he's going to have to come to grips with that.
You know, speaking of early childhood, Paul Revel, let's start with some things that Charlie Baker has focused on either post his election in November or in his inaugural speech the other day. One of the major differences, I think, between Martha Coakley and Baker during the campaign was Martha Coakley was an all-in on universal pre-K, even though she scaled it back a little bit post-primary. And Charlie said, yeah, I'm for expanding. I should call him Governor Baker now. Governor Baker said, I'm for expanding universal pre-K, but we've got to strengthen what happens from K on. Where should he be going here, and where is it likely that he does go?
Well, I think it's a question of both and. And I felt that he was, the governor was kind of skeptical about early childhood in the campaign phase. And I hope that he talks with colleagues. For example, the new governor in Illinois is a big advocate of early childhood education. His wife's an activist in that field. The data is really compelling on early childhood in terms of return on investment. I know Governor Baker said he was concerned, well, even if you did a good job in early childhood, if you pass them along to failing schools in the primary years, that would be a problem. And that's a legitimate concern to have. But it's just undeniable. If kids enter kindergarten and they're already, as I found frequently as secretary, way behind their peers, you have kids coming in with one-third the vocabulary of the child that they're sitting next to, unless you do something dramatic to make that up, that child is going to be behind forever. So early childhood has just got huge benefits.
Well, one of the things that Charlie Baker was in favor of, more so than Martha Coakley, is expanding charter schools. And you were the secretary under Deval Patrick, I think 2007, 2013,
right,
for quite some time. So you saw this this expansion begin to happen. And the new education secretary, Jim Pizer, has been a big promoter of charter schools.
That's right.
How much do they matter in terms of his willingness that would be Baker's to expand? And how much is that going to matter to closing this achievement gap, which we hear about all the time? And everybody knows this means the differences among white kids, black kids, Latino kids, inner city suburbs, that kind of thing.
Well, it's a very hot issue. And frankly, I think it's been made too hot an issue by the media in some respects because it's a great David and Goliath story. But it's important to put it in perspective. Charter schools enroll 3.6% of all students in the Commonwealth right now. This is after 20-some years of education reform. They play an important part. We have some of the best charter schools in the country right here in Boston doing an extraordinary job with students. And yet at the same time, for the foreseeable future, the overwhelming majority of our children are going to be in mainstream schools. And that's where the focus has got to be on improvement. Now, I think one of the potential pitfalls, I said one of the challenges for this administration coming in is a budget. Another is that we get enormously distracted by an all-out, full-bore war on charter schools because this administration has made strong campaign promises that they want to deliver a cap lift. We delivered in the Patrick administration the most meaningful cap lift since charter schools began. It was hard work, but it was a smart cap lift, and it did a lot of good. There was another attempt last year that failed. I think they're going to try that again, and I think they should. They should try and get some kind of a modified cap lift. But at the same time, if they put all their eggs in that basket, and then you've got an MTA leadership in the Mass Teachers Association that is all out against charter schools, we run the risk of all the oxygen in the education reform movement being absorbed by charter schools. And there's so many other things that need to be done, not just in K-12, but in higher education
and
in early childhood.
But isn't the problem is that Democrats on Beacon Hill don't have the courage to try to reach some sort of sane compromise and move ahead with this thing. I mean, the situation Senator Chang Diaz found herself in, where she was contorted into a pretzel, you know, between parents. Marjorie wrote this brilliant column. I don't remember when you wrote it.
Thank you, Jim.
No, you wrote a column that literally almost made me cry about the woman who would no longer go to the lotteries because she knew her chance was, what, 1 out of 9?
Well,
what's the name of the Flaherty Brothers movie, too?
Oh, Waiting for Superman.
Waiting for Superman.
A very pro-charter school movie. It was almost, you know, it was almost a crusade for
stereotype unions.
But one thing that's true in Boston, and you certainly know this better than we do, is that there are thousands of kids who want to go to charter schools in Boston. And I think Charlie Baker hit on a nerve when he talked about education being the civil rights issue of our time in terms of poor kids and mostly kids of color not being able to get access to these good schools. And at this particular school in Boston, where, of course, you go in at 5 and 6 o'clock and the place is still open and kids are getting tutored, and it's a very different experience. And if you go to a closed, or some of them are open later, but most of them are not open until 6 o'clock at night, the regular public schools. And what happened was that they were having the lottery that day and nobody was there, and I was surprised. But I learned that nobody was there who'd participate in the lottery because it was too depressing to keep getting turned out of the lottery year after year after year. And this one mother of three, I think she'd been turned down already about a dozen times, and she just said, what is the point in going and getting all excited and being crushed? So that's the thing I think you're talking about.
Right. If they want charter schools, why shouldn't they get them?
No, I agree. I mean, I think we should make more seats available, but I think it's important that they be in places where the need is high, the demand is high, and that they be provided by people who know what they're doing. We have, just as we have some very strong charter schools, on average across the country, charter schools are not a silver bullet. And this is where we get into a problem, is some people who feel it's the absolute answer in public education. It's the cure-all. It's the panacea. And others, you know, and I'm afraid some of my Democratic friends are in this category, others who feel it's the absolute scourge of public education. It's the end of freedom and civilization as we know it. And we get to this bipolar war when the answer is really somewhere in the middle. I'd like to see more seats. I'd like to see our best schools grown. You can't help but be overwhelmingly impressed by those schools. But at the same time, I don't want our whole discussion going forward for the next 2 or 3 years to be about charter schools.
What should, instead of spending our time on what you say are the 3.6% of schools, of course, supporters of charter schools would say it's 3.6 because of the Democratic opposition.
That's right.
Historically.
But that tells you something about the political realities, doesn't it,
understood.
After 20 years?
But so where should the bulk of our focus on public education be, if not on the charter debate?
Number one, it isn't all K-12, but within K-12, we can work on improving the quality of teaching. We can work around turning around chronically underperforming schools. I know Governor Baker is impressed with what's happened up in Lawrence.
This achievement gap thing is both a Deval Patrick and a Charlie Baker
thing,
big time.
Yeah, I mean, it's an everybody thing. We're not going to be able to grow an economy in a state like this that relies on high-skill, high-knowledge jobs and growing them unless we get everybody up to a high level. We're the top-performing state in the country in terms of educational achievement, and yet we still have huge achievement gaps. So what are we going to do to close those gaps? Got to start early in early childhood. We got to continue into higher education, make sure people get degrees and technical certificates so they can go to work in mid-skill level jobs and things of this nature. Career pathways through high school is really important. Turning around chronically underperforming schools. I mean, there's a whole list of things we really need to attend to.
Well, you know, there have been some kind of exciting reforms, depending on your perspective. You mentioned before the new head of the MTA, Barbara Mandoloni. She had a great quote about rich white men who are deciding the course of public education for black and brown children. She's not in favor of a lot of these reforms that the rich white men have come up with, at least in her estimation. But
Are you rich, by the way, or just white, Paul? I want to be...
I think I probably strike out on all counts here.
Yeah.
But this is the problem, is the debate gets personalized and sort of on both sides. You know, you got people on the far right. You got the Pioneer Institute going after this, that, and everybody ad hominem attacks. You've got Barbara Mandoloni, you know, coming in from the left. And it gets all embroiled in a debate that distracts us from the really important thing, which is what do we have in the way of strategies for improving student learning?
Well, one of the things I think is exciting in Boston anyway is this ability of principals to have more control over the teachers that they hire. That seems to me to be a big deal. Explain that to people, the way it used to work and the way it works now.
Well, I mean, in the typical school system, a principal is a mid-level manager. And the paradox is, under education reform, they're being held accountable for the performance of the building, but they can't really build their team because usually teachers are assigned to them by the central office. And because it's relatively difficult to eliminate teachers and change the composition of your faculty within a school, you're stuck with those that particular faculty. And if they don't want to go along with your strategy, unless they do something egregiously wrong, you have to work with that group of people. But you're accountable for how they perform. So in Boston, they have found and worked with the union and made changes and provisions in the contract that allow the teachers to have much more, the principals to have much more discretion in terms of appointing the team that will be working in that building, irrespective of factors like seniority. And so that's a big step forward.
Yeah.
They get to assemble their own team, and that team then works with the principal in executing educational strategies for which they're all held accountable.
But at the same time, from what I've read, and this has left, I think it's 72 teachers in Boston basically without a classroom because they have not been chosen to fill the openings by their principals, and so they're kind of hanging out there. What's the deal with that?
Well, they've made provision for, you know, this is how they dealt with this issue of bumping and whether or not they were just going to have people simply go into positions by virtue of seniority. And now there's an excess pool that has a limited period of time where they're waiting for new assignments. If there's a long-term substitute kind of position or other positions to be filled, they can draw off of them. But that's not ideal either, to have a pool of people that we're paying for. But it's a compromise in terms of the contract language and making it more possible for principals to have control over who works in their
building. At the same time, there's a huge budget deficit for Boston,
that's
too.
That's right.
We're speaking to Paul Revel, former Secretary of Education under Deval Patrick, and now he is at Harvard. You know, speaking of this budget deficit and staying in Boston just for a second, we are going to get to higher ed, so for those of you concerned about it out there, don't worry. We'll get there. At the same time there's this budget deficit, the mayor, Boston's mayor, Marty Walsh, has cut a deal with the union to provide for, in certain settings, longer school days phased in over 3 years. The statewide effort has been led by Chris Gabrielli in this
That's
Mass
right.
2020 thing. We discuss this on the air probably every few months. Other than the low-income family who needs the afternoon income of their son or daughter to help prop up the family's finances, I have never heard one good argument against a longer school day, except for the fact that the reality is we can't afford it. Is there a good argument against it, and can we afford it?
I'm the wrong person to talk to for a negative argument on that. I've headed the first Massachusetts Commission on Time and Learning way
back.
Because the implication to me of adopting a standards-based system was to sort of change that paradigm where we said, we've got a fixed amount of time, and either you get it or you don't, and we'll either socially promote you or hold you back, neither of which is a very good alternative. And the implication of standards-based reform was it's not about seat time anymore. It's about whatever time you need to master the topic. And, however, that's inconvenient for adults because the amount of time it takes you may be shorter than it
sure.
takes me. And Marjorie may need something in between. And that's sloppy and inconvenient, so we didn't do it. We basically did standards but gave everybody the same one-size-fits-all system, and it turns out it doesn't work for everybody. So I think it's really smart to provide, particularly in our urban areas, particularly with children who don't have a lot of enriching activities to do after school, extended school time, which doesn't mean more of the same. It's not more drill and kill or more of the exact same kind of classes, but enriching activities, additional tutoring or instruction.
But are we going to ante up? I mean, it seems like virtually everybody, with a couple of exceptions, is in favor of it, except when you have to belly up to the proverbial bar and pay the bill. I mean, is this something that will be? I know you think it should be prioritized by the people who set budgets.
Well, I hope so. We haven't done a good job. I mean, Chris Gabrielli, Mass 2020, has done a terrific job in piloting those ELT schools in Massachusetts. But
what does ELT stand for?
Extended learning time.
Okay.
But, you know, that experiment has remained relatively small over time. And it does take a financial commitment. There are other ways to do it than simply extending the teacher contract within a district. There are all kinds of outside providers like Citizen Schools and YMCAs and Boys and Girls Clubs and myriad organizations who can do things with kids after school, in school settings or in other settings, and do it probably at a much lower rate. So I think we've got to be a little bit more creative about how we solve that problem, but it's a problem worth working on, and it isn't a one-size-fits-all. We don't need to prescribe that for Newton and Weston and Wellesley. They're fine after school. But in Boston, you know, we find out, you know, kids spend 20% of their waking hours between kindergarten and grade 12 in school. The other 80% is out of school. And wealthy kids these days are getting so much access to sort of 24/7 yeah. enrichment of one kind or another. And poor kids whose parents are finding it harder to make a living than ever before are getting less and less. And those disparities and what happens in that 80% of out-of-school time turns out to have every bit as much to do with achievement gaps as anything that happens in school. And so consequently, unless we deal with that, we are going to continue to have achievement gaps no matter how hard we work to optimize schools.
But it's not just the school. I've said this 1,000 times in the air. Do you remember Kathy Kelly, who was president of the Boston Teachers Union? She was a first or kindergarten teacher, one of the greats ever.
Yep,
and she would testify. I sat there when she testified in front of the key budget committees and say, if you're going to give me more money for my schools and that's it, don't bother. Because if my kid comes to school and he or she is hungry because they didn't have a decent breakfast, they feel unsafe walking through their neighborhood,
that's right.
their parents are screaming at each other at home, they can't learn when they enter the classroom. So the thing that's needed to fix that achievement gap that Deval Patrick has spoken so eloquently about and has been highlighted by Charlie Baker is so much broader than just, as you say, what happens within the four walls of a classroom.
Well, this is the work that we do at the Education Redesign Lab, and one of the key points in terms of designing a future for education, in other words, learning the lesson from Massachusetts. We did education reform here, standards-based reform, as well as any state in the country. We invested as much money per student as any state in the country, and still, after 20 years, we lead the nation, comparatively speaking, so we're proud of that, but we have deep, persistent achievement gaps, and they line up with the usual suspects. In other words, there's still an iron law correlation between poverty and and socioeconomic status and educational achievement and attainment. So unless you deal with the issues that get in the way of kids coming to school in the first place and supplying motivated effort, you can optimize schools until the cows come home, but if they're not there or they can't concentrate because of all the factors you mentioned, then we can't do it. And for a long time, educators said, well, we live in our silo. We can't deal with that. We know it's relevant, but we don't really have the tools to deal with it. We as taxpayers pay for a lot of the health and human services that happen in other silos around. We've got to figure out a way to bring them together.
We're talking with Paul Revel. He was the Secretary of Education in the Patrick administration. Let me ask you some big picture questions. You know, poor people have always been with us. Immigrants have always been with us. There's always been crime. Maybe it's more intense now in the inner city. But there's this perception that, you know, once upon a time, maybe ending in the 1970s, American schools were really leading the world in every category, and that people had a lot of confidence in the public schools. You sent your kid to the public school. Even in a city, you could get a good education. That's not true anymore. The confidence is lost, except maybe in the West Ends and the Wellesleys and the Brooklines and stuff. So what happened?
Well, I think the world around us changed, Marjorie. I mean, I think in the last quarter of the 20th century, a lot of leaders, governors in particular, also business leaders. That's how it happened in Massachusetts. And I was fortunate enough to be associated with the Mass Business Alliance, who saw this coming for a long time. When you looked at international competition, other countries had been growing and improving their education systems. When you looked at automation, we began to lose low-skill, low-knowledge, routine kinds of jobs in this country in the last quarter of the 20th century. Used to be you could drop out with an 8th or 9th grade education, go to work on the General Motors assembly line in Framingham, and make a decent middle-class living, own your own house, buy a car, take a summer vacation, send your kids to college. You know, by the end of the 20th century, those jobs were gone. And we began to realize, well, we need a high-skill, high-knowledge education system. And instead of something that, you know, sort of reproduces a bell curve over a fairly low center of achievement, we now need to get everybody to the high-end tail of the distribution. We now need all children, and we said all means all, at a level of high skill and high knowledge so they can participate in 21st century jobs that are otherwise lower skill jobs are being automated or sent offshore. And we set that as a goal, but we didn't build the system to achieve that goal. We took the old engine that was built for the early 20th century, lots of immigrants, lots of factory jobs that required next to no skill to do, batch process, mass produce education in the early 20th century. And we said, we're going to just fix that old engine and strap on standards and glom on choice, put a choice carburetor on it, and a few other, add a kindergarten and a middle school, and it'll do the job. You know, it was meant to go 30 miles an hour. We want it to go 120. And it's not going to go 120 unless we build out and figure out how to sort of develop our children and educate our children in ways that encompass their whole lives rather than just this narrow intervention of schooling, which is just too weak on average to create the kind of equality that Horace Mann envisioned.
That's the voice of Paul Revel. Paul, one last K through 12, and then we got to hit you on the affordability of higher ed before
you go
away.
Two last K through 12.
Okay. what's the future? And give me a short answer if you can. What's the future of tech? I am amongst the anti testing zealots in the spirit of full disclosure. I understand the rationale, but when I've had kids in public school from junior K, all they do is they do fine in them. All they do is complain about them. All their friends complain about them. The teachers complain about them. What's the future?
Well, I have a daughter who complains about them too and complained to me about them just last night, so I'm fresh off of this. We work in a field where historically there was little or no accountability for performance. Tests are really yardsticks. No one ever fattened a cow by weighing it. But periodically, you do weigh the cow to decide whether or not you're ready for market. In education, we
love agricultural imagery on the show, by the way. So we thank you.
I will bear that in mind. So it's not worth attacking the yardstick. I mean, testing is something that we need to do periodically to understand whether or not what we're doing in schools makes a difference. I view this whole regime of standards, assessment, and accountability as an equity strategy. In other words, we know who was doing well and who was doing poorly before we had any standards. We had a system that was best at replicating the existing social order, and students of color and poor students didn't do well. Now, at least they're at the center of our conversation about how to improve education, because every time we show these testing results and we show these wide disparities, we as people in the policy community or in the community at large have sort of come up to grips with the gap between our aspirations and our performance, and we have to either recommit to going after these achievement gaps or back off and say, well, we don't really think we can do that, and that's obviously the wrong answer.
Okay, one last K through 12, because I am obsessed with this. One of my theories, and it's just based on nothing, but anyway, is that when I was young a million years ago, women could be nurses, they could be secretaries, or they could be teachers. And these women that were great intellectuals that could have been, lawyers at Harvard Law School, didn't have that opportunity, they became teachers. That's changed because teachers don't get the respect they used to, they don't get enough money, et cetera, all those arguments. And the great intellectuals, male and female, are not going into the teaching profession, and that has really hurt education.
I think you're onto something. It's definitely true about women and the nature of the marketplace change for women and for their services coming into the marketplace. But I think what we need to do is create a profession that is really attractive and sustaining for young people who have choices to come into. We've proved through Teach for America, for example, that you can go around to the elite colleges in the country and attract top students who have other choices to come into teaching. What Teach for America hasn't proved, and what the school systems in America haven't proved, is that we can keep those folks in teaching. Because the nature of the jobs when they get in there is so punishing, so isolating. We have so little in the way of a human resource development system, a talent development system within many of our big city school systems, that people leave after 2 or 3 years. And so I think we've shown we can attract people. There are lots of smart, idealistic, talented, energetic young people who want to come into teaching. But how do we bring them to jobs that are worth doing for 10, 15, 20 years? We don't need people to necessarily come and teach for 45 years in the same role that, has been done in the past. But getting people to teach 10, 15 years, 20 years, that's something we've got to work on. And that, I think, is a function of the kind of reforms we need to make in schools in terms of how we develop talent, how we mentor people and bring them in, how we evaluate them when they're on the job, what kind of supervision and feedback we give them. That kind of support, I think, is what we need to focus on.
Okay, final 2 minutes, Paul Revel, former Secretary of Education, on the affordability of higher ed. Let's stay within the public sector just for these purposes. One, what's the most important idea, for example, in the UMass system, other than just increased state funding so the cost sharing goes? And two, Deval Patrick, I think with you there, proposed early on and went nowhere, free community colleges. 8 years later, Barack Obama is proposing the exact same thing. That would be a huge step in the right direction, no?
No, we're totally supportive of it, and you're absolutely right. Governor Patrick did propose that at the beginning of the administration, and then summer of 2008 came along, and we had this great recession, and we were unable to deliver the financial resources to do it. I mean, we need to recognize that the ante has gone up in terms of what's an entry credential that's going to allow you to participate meaningfully in this economy, and at a minimum, a two-year associate's degree seems to be the place to start.
So how about in the four-year thing, though, for a second? You guys actually cut state funding for UMass system for a while. I know it's been restored.
During the recession.
I understand.
But, yeah.
And we're back to, what, a 50-50 split?
UMass we are, but not at the other, not at some of the other
schools. So give us a quick, what's the silver bullet, if there is one here, to use your expression of earlier, to make public higher education more affordable for the average kid in Massachusetts?
I don't think there is a silver bullet. That's the problem, Jim, is that, over a period of a couple of decades here, the cost of higher education has gone up. The state has not kept pace with its share. So more and more of that burden has been passed on to students and their families. And it's becoming unsupportable right now. And so it's going to take a significant state investment, which is difficult, obviously, for any administration now to contemplate because we're dealing with a budget crisis. So how do we work our way out of that? We've got to be creative. We've got to look for – I mean, I think one of the suggestions is by virtue of making community college free, as the president has proposed for everybody – you will actually drive more people into community colleges, which has a lower per pupil cost than four-year colleges, because community colleges are not all trying to mimic, Division I sort of research institutions. So that's an approach you can take here. We've got to get more creative in terms of what we do to help people sustain and persist in higher education. We've got to get stronger in terms of our accountability system. The Vision Project that Richard Freeland, the Commissioner of Higher Education, has developed in Massachusetts does two things effectively. It begins to introduce accountability into higher education, which we really haven't had. What we got in K-12 in 1993, higher education has never embraced that kind of accountability. And the Vision Project is a first tentative but good effort at doing that. And secondly, it forces the higher education system to be more responsive to state government and to our needs in terms of jobs out in the communities.
Okay, Paul, as you're walking out the door, you have to assure Marjorie and me that when we invite you back in 20 years, we'll have you back before that. We're not having the exact same discussion about the state of public education.
Well, yeah, some of these things are circular, and I think it's our role to kind of broaden the conversation and challenge people so we move beyond purely the hot topics and delve down into some of the things that really are in the boiler works but need to be done. So I hope that's the case, too.
Paul, it's great to see you.
Thank you very much for taking the time to come in.
Thank
Paul
you.
Revel is the Francis Keppel Professor of Practice and of Educational Policy and Administration at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he's also the director of the Education Redesign Lab. Up next, WGBH Arts Editor Jared Bowen joins us to go over the latest to hit the local arts scene. That's coming up on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Today, it's about Resurrection. Rothko gets a reboot at the Harvard Arts Museum. Molly Ivins comes to life at the Lyric Stage. And Walden gets fresh interpretations at the De Cordova. Here with us to review these and other local arts events is WGBH's arts editor, Jared Bowen. Jared, nice to see you.
Great to see you.
I heard you were fabulous sitting in for me part of last week. Is that true?
Fabulous. We had a fabulous time.
I hate that, by the way.
Yeah.
The goal when you're off, let me
is.
Just be clear about this, is to have somebody be pretty good so the audience keeps listening, but not too good, if you know what I mean?
If you taste that little bit of antifreeze in your coffee every morning, that is not me, Jim.
That's
I had
right.
nothing to do with it.
Well, we did have a wonderful time while you were gone. Well, anyway, let's talk with this Muckrakers, which is so relevant to what's going on today. It's the Barrington Stage Company's production. Tell us about it.
It started at Barrington Stage, and it just opened last night, actually, at the New Repertory Theater.
Oh, great.
And this is a very, very relevant play. It's, just like Selma, that it stays as resonant through the times. And here you find two people who come together. One is a Smith graduate. She's in her 20s. And she has a website where basically it's gossip mongering, and she feels it's her prerogative to out celebrities and out congressmen and put information about people out there, anybody who's in the public eye. She's hosting this British hacker who has released a trove of documents. It was written right around the time of Julian Assange, and of course it was right before Snowden and everything else that we've seen come to the fore. And over the course of this one evening, you see these two, it's a two-hander, you see these two characters go back and forth about what they're doing and the morality of what they're doing. She comes at it from the point of view of a 20-year-old where everything is up for grabs. He's a little bit more reticent. He believes that only documents should be released if they serve the nation, if there are things happening that need to be corrected. So not everybody has surrendered their right to privacy. So it becomes this great discussion. But you also have this sexual interplay between the two over the course of
the night.
Look
at the smile on Jared's face.
Well,
there.
I'm a little bit embarrassed. I think it was probably the most graphic sex scene I've ever seen depicted on
the
stage.
Really?
He said that at the morning meeting, and people right away wanted to know how they could get tickets.
Well, what can you tell us without crossing the line? What does that mean?
About the sex scene?
Yes, about the sex.
Well, there's nudity, and there's you feel like you're watching. It's, oh, my God, how old am I that I can't even discuss
it? You feel like you're watching people have sex. Is that what you're trying to say, Jared?
Yes, Marjorie
you
Egan. Catholic reporter Marjorie Egan.
That's right. Crux now,
Catholic
the Catholic
columnist.
Guy, the Catholic spirituality. I think Catholics are allowed to have sex. I'm not really sure. But Jared, let me ask you this, though. I didn't realize this was going on in plays. I kind of thought, you know, the hair and all this from a million years ago were sort of the exceptions. But people do get naked in the theater.
Well, they do. And it usually it's done very judiciously and carefully and rightly. And I think that's the case here because not only are you seeing this exchange of intellectualism and ideas and people who are sort of measuring varying degrees of criminality because of what they're doing, but you also see themselves measuring each other with sex.
Right.
So it works. And who has – and. We see this always in fiction, sex being used as power, and that's certainly the case here.
Did you say, and I was pulling my notes when you started talking about it, did you mention who was behind this thing?
Oh, yes.
I mean, this is fascinating. Who's the director, the writer? Who's
the writer
of this thing?
The writer, yeah. Is
the child
son of the former Weather Underground leaders Bill Ayers and Bernadette Dorn, his wife.
And by the way, if people hear the name Bill Ayers and they're saying, well, I don't know anything about the Weather Underground, the reason you're thinking Bill Ayers is because of
Barack
the whole
Obama,
brouhaha
right.
about Barack Obama and
he had
Ayers'
Barack
connection
Obama.
In Chicago.
Had his first coffee clutch or something in Bill Ayers' house, and he was forever united with him in those circles where people didn't like Obama. But what a fascinating and talk about growing up with secrets, because I think that they were on the lam for quite a while, were they not, Ayers and Dorn?
They were, and then there became this big discussion with Sarah Palin weighing in, and he's discussed that about watching his family saga play out. And his name is I.E. Dorn, and it's his prerogative as a playwright to sort of weigh these issues and have them manifest themselves on the stage. So you have no idea necessarily where he comes down. Because I will also say another great thing about this play, and it's a very, very tight 75 minutes. There are lots of twists and turns that take you in different places and it makes you shift your own thinking about where you might come down on some of these issues.
Oh.
So it's very, very provocative in an intellectual way, too.
By the way, we're going to do a whole segment on the sex scene later today, and so Jared will be back with us. Now, let me
Jim's getting many tickets for many nights.
Something I am dying to see. Number one, because I was a huge fan of Molly Ivins. And number two, I actually bumped into the PR person for this theater, who knows you, at a Whole Foods, where else do I bump into anybody? And for those who don't know about Molly Ivins, tell us about her before you tell us. Well, I guess you'll be telling about the play. It's the same deal.
Well, Molly Ivins, in the words of her mother, she was a Saint Bernard among greyhounds. That's one of the great early lines
that
in the play.
That is great.
Molly Ivins was, of course, this great Texas rabble-rouser. She was a columnist, a writer, a provocateur. She took down anybody and everybody. She was more liberal. She was very aligned with the ACLU. But that didn't prevent her from taking down Clinton with her words. Of course, shrub. George W. Bush, she's the one who coined the term shrub for him. But she, all was fair in love and war and politics in Texas, where she was from. And this play is really fun. It's called Red Hot Patriot, the kick-ass wit of Molly Ivins at the Lyric Stage Company.
It's a one-woman deal.
It's
yes?
a one-woman, essentially there's one character who sort of meanders about, but it's really Karen McDonald playing Molly Ivins. I also had the fortune of just meeting her in passing here once at WGBH.
Ivins?
Molly Ivins,
oh,
yeah.
I'm so jealous.
Emily Rooney had her on a couple of times, and this is my favorite line. When Emily had her on, we were dying in the control room. She was describing Arnold Schwarzenegger, whose head looks like a condom stuffed with walnuts, which... Isn't that the best description of what Arnold Schwarzenegger
looked like? Oh, my God. Well, you know, she also died quite young, relatively 62 years old, of breast cancer in 2007, as the review by Joel Brown points out. But this is to just give people a flavor of Molly Ivins, and I was a huge fan of hers. I had her, books of her columns that she wrote. Here's what he quotes. Six out of the last seven House speakers have been indicted for one thing or another in Texas, the exception being the one who was shot to death by his wife. She was indicted, but not convicted, because in Texas, we recognize public service when we see it. I mean, how great a line is that? She was brilliant, and I think she was really big.
She was six feet tall, so yeah. She was this domineering presence, and she was, of course, a very domineering presence in her writing. She had this great wit. I'll share a couple more lines with you. This is just me shamelessly stealing from the play.
Why not?
Of one Texas legislator, she said, if his IQ dips any lower, we'll have to water him twice a day.
And that is so great.
I just lost the other. Elvis Presley. She worked for the New York Times at one point, and she said she was just miserable at five times her salary. But she was able to write his obituary, where she wrote Presley was plagued with issues of caloric intake. So she just had this great way of perception. But the play takes us through her life and how she basically gets at the essence of Molly Ivins, how she arrived at her conviction in her writing and her take and her political acumen. And we get a somewhat of a biographical sketch, too, about a couple of lovers that she had who she lost to death, about the influence of her parents on her life. She had a very complicated relationship with her father. She had a very complicated relationship with the drink, and she had to get herself off that. She thought, like many writers, that she could only be sharp if she drank, and then we see her grappling with breast cancer at the end of her life. So in addition to this very, very entertaining wit, you also get, I think some people have criticized it as not being enough of a story, but I don't think that's true. I think it was just enough to really give us a sense. And in Karen McDonald's very capable hands, it's hugely enjoyable.
You know, before we move on to the next, how are the sex scenes in this particular? Oh, they're not. Okay.
They are non-existent.
Okay. And by the way, that's at the Huntington until February 1st. I am dying to see this thing.
The Lyric Stage Company.
Oh, it is Lyric? I'm sorry. That's my Lyric. Apologies. Yep. Finally, on the play front, Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike. What is that?
Yeah, what's this?
This is great. Maybe it's an unfortunate title unless you're a Chekhov fan.
Yeah.
You're Chekhovian in your interests. This is a comedy by Christopher Drang, and it's very, very funny. This is the one that's at the Huntington through February 1st. It premiered on Broadway either last year or a couple of years ago. I saw it there. It was very good, and this is just as good. And you have a couple of siblings, Sonia and Vanya, who are living in their parents' home in Bucks County, and they're really realizing that they've never lived. They've taken their care of their parents, their very intellectual parents, for most of their lives, and now they're just sort of facing each other, and they have this great sibling rivalry. It's hilarious. They take after each other, but this is all disrupted when their sister Masha comes home, and Masha is a very celebrated actress. She'd like to be more celebrated. She never did the classic roles. She only did serial killer movies that made her very popular, and she's bringing home Spike, who's her 20-something-year-old lover.
Oh, gosh.
Who likes... This is the segment about sex. Apparently, he likes to take his clothes off frequently, to the delight of Vanya in particular. So you have the family dynamics at age 60 all coming together. So you can only imagine what happens in this home. It's extremely funny. And as they're looking back at their life and just sort of settled into how complicated they are and kind of indulging in how complicated they are, you see it come to the fore. It's just a really fun night on a cold winter night.
You know, I said this to Jim when we were upstairs before the show began. It is amazing to me every time we talked to you, Jared, how much theater is going on in Boston at the same time. And apparently, there's an audience to sustain that theater.
There is, because we have really good theater companies. I think that's why. And it's so disparate. I mean, look at the three plays that I just spoke about. I mean, one has issues that are totally ripped from the headlines and resonant. You have this appreciation of Molly Ivins and a one-woman show. And then you just have a really enjoyable comedy. There is so much to choose from. So there is something for everyone.
By the way, let me just correct, as Jared did a couple of minutes ago, Vanya, etc., is at the Huntington until February 1st, and Red Hot Patriot about Molly Ivins is at the Lyric until January 31st. Let's move to the movie front, if we can. Before we do, did you watch the Golden Globes?
I did watch the Golden Globes.
Boyhood and Budapest, drama and comedy. Did they What did you think of the choices?
I'm finally seeing Boyhood this week. Uh-huh. I hadn't seen it, but from everything I hear, I think that's fine. The Golden Globes are great because they kind of go off the mark. They're not always an indicator of what we'll see at the Academy Awards. But Grand Budapest Hotel, I think that was a great movie. It was very, very well made. It's one of Wes Anderson's better movies of the last few years.
He's an odd duck, is he not?
He's very well. I love that joke about it. He came. What did they say? He came. Tina Fey and Amy Poehler said he arrived at the Golden Globes wearing I just killed the joke. I just ruined it. I just destroyed it.
So what did she say about Wes Anderson? Go
ahead. Well, I forgot half of it. That's why I quit in the middle. That he arrived on a bike made out of some parts. I can't remember. I shouldn't have started talking.
Okay,
about
Okay, so that's in other true. Words, he was made a strange arrival at the Golden Globes.
Because he's
that's
quirky.
That's good enough. Okay.
So Inherent Vice is the one new movie in town that you have on your list. What Thomas Pynchon? I mean, that's an odd sort of... Is that movie ever been made of
his
books?
No, this is the first one.
Okay, and?
And it's an odd movie, but it's in the hands of Paul Thomas Anderson, Magnolia, Boogie Nights. So it's very, very bizarre. I enjoyed it, but I feel like this movie is an experience because you have Doc, who is played by Joaquin Phoenix, and he's working out of a medical office, but he's a private investigator. Maya Rudolph is the receptionist there.
Oh.
So immediately that should give you a sense of what we're dealing with here, but it's 1970 in California. So it's just the end of the psychedelic 1960s and everything's about to become a little bit more conservative. We're tightening up and Joaquin Phoenix's girlfriend has come to him to tell him that her billionaire boyfriend is caught up in some sort of kidnap scheme. So he's set off on this adventure to try to figure out what has happened. It becomes very psychedelic. You don't know whether he's going after a dental cartel or a drug cartel or what's happening. The dentist in this case is played by Martin Short, who is just unbelievably and deliciously bizarre.
Love him.
Josh Brolin is this cop who is also demented. I mean, he should get an Oscar nomination out of this. So it's just you kind of just allow yourself to slip into these waters and be pushed and pulled and tugged around, and you're never really certain what's happening, but it's a fun experience all the while it's happening.
You know, by the way, since you blew a line from the Golden Globes, can I blow one too? Since
yes.
you mentioned
yes,
Joaquin
go ahead.
Phoenix.
Please help
I don't know if it was Amy Poehler or Tina Fey who said, and unfortunately one of the nominees will not be here tonight because he does not believe in award shows. Hey, Joaquin, how are you? And he's sitting there. By the way, speaking of first time a Pynchon book has been made into a movie, it's a great line, and I think it's in The New Yorker. It says, nobody has ever turned a Pynchon book into a movie before for the same reason that nobody has managed to cram the New York Philharmonic into a Ford Focus, which is a pretty good line. You know, one last thing on the movie front is I'm a little embarrassed for you in light of the fact that you are the arts editor at GBH. Unlike me, who, as a dutiful patriot, have watched in the confines of my home The Interview, you have not, correct?
No, because I'm too busy out seeing sex on stage.
Okay, can I say one thing about it before you watch it, if you do? The one thing that is not mentioned in all the horrible reviews, and by the way, it's racist, and it is sophomoric humor, and it's Eminem plays an interviewee as himself. It is a riot. It is absolutely staggeringly funny, and it's worth watching just for that one little 5-minute segment.
But otherwise, not worth watching.
It is moronic, and it is racist, and it is. But it's
well, you know,
whatever.
What the hell?
Other than that, it's a
great
movie.
Okay. So, what's going on at the Decordova, please?
This is really fun. This is a show called Walden Revisited, and the Decordova Sculpture Park Museum is in Lincoln. It's 2 miles from Walden Pond, and where Henry David Thoreau famously went into the woods to live his simple life about 70 years ago. And they have assembled a group of artists who consider Henry David Thoreau, and they call them Neo-Thoreauvians. I love that term.
Neo-Thoreauvians.
They call them Neo-Thoreauvians and really consider what Walden means today. And the interesting thing about this is when Henry David Thoreau wrote Walden in the mid-1800s. It didn't really resonate. And actually, this is why I love history, too. It didn't resonate until the 1930s and the Great Depression. And Americans had to return to simplicity just by circumstance because of the economy had tanked. And suddenly there was this appreciation for Walden. And it continues to surface again and again, and including this time where we're so concerned about the environment and what's happening and recycling and having no carbon footprint. So you have this wide range range of artistic interpretations in the show, which I think is really, really sublime. You have one artist who there was a passage in Walden about Henry David Thoreau as surveying the pond, and you have this artist who does that color by color. You know, the color changes with the clouds overhead changing, with the depth of the water. You have all these different – so he's painted this, and it's this map that just lines out all – sprawls out all across the museum floor. You have another artist who has Henry David Thoreau's desk, which must be assembled to John Cage's music, and John Cage is somebody who is influenced by Thoreau. So it's all these sort of really different machinations and interpretations. But some people also take a lighter approach because Henry David Thoreau, even though he had gone into the woods, he still went home to have dinner with his mother pretty routinely. So he didn't go far into the woods. And so you have this artist who goes into the woods herself, but it's actually her father's pop-up camper in upstate New York. So you see this video of her dancing around in her fur bikini. But I think one of the most salient pieces is you see a projection of two different cabins. One's a recreation of Henry David Thoreau's cabin in his view, and the other is of somebody who is very inspired by Thoreau's writings in Montana, and that was the Unabomber. And so he went and captured what the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, was seeing outside his cabin. So it makes you think about the legacy and different extrapolations of what it means to go into the woods and separate yourself from society.
Are you an into the woods kind of guy? I don't see that. Is that happening?
You know what? I actually quoted in my college yearbook at Emerson College, I quoted Henry David Thoreau.
You did? Really?
I did. I had totally forgotten that until I was reading the book again, and then suddenly I remembered. That's where I was in my life at that point.
Wow.
All right, let's move on to Harvard University, Mark Rothkau's Harvard Murals. You know,
I'm fascinated by this story, by the way.
Well, I always had a tough time with – when I think of him, I think of those blocks of color, and I just don't ever – I don't get it. So I guess I'm a Neanderthal or
okay,
something.
No, so she'll recuse herself.
That's okay.
Can you define the term in painting before we begin this? I never heard the term.
Oh, in painting for in conservation. Painting.
Yeah, what does that mean?
It's when the conservators go and basically fill in. Of course, there's years of study to figure out the exact amount of paint – pigment color, paint color, how it's going to affect, but none of that is done here.
Right, but in the traditional sense, just if the color starts to fade or the paint is chipping
chips,
off, that's
yep.
where they do it.
Yep.
But they do in kind of in painting, as you said, that's never been done before. Correct?
They do. They do. This
what
is fascinating. So at Harvard, it's I love this story. In the 1960s, Harvard commissioned Rothko to paint a series of murals for this penthouse dining room, and it was major even in the 60s. Rothko was already a tremendously huge figure in the art world. So he painted these five murals that went up into this penthouse dining room, at which the shades were never drawn because they had these great Harvard Yard views and Charles River views. So the sun came in, and because of the paint that Rothko used, the sun began right away bleaching the paintings. So within about 10 years, they had been taken down, and they largely disappeared from view over these last 30 to 40 years. There have been a couple of exhibitions, but they really couldn't be trotted out because they had changed so dramatically. And they disappeared from consciousness, and it was terrible because it was only one of three series that Rothko ever painted. But now, for the opening of the new Harvard Art Museums, Harvard teamed up with some teams around the country, Switzerland, MIT, to come up with this technology where they basically surveyed Rothko's paint murals and the paint because they had studies so they knew what the original color was supposed to be. And they have recreated the murals pixel by pixel, millions and millions of pixels. And they developed a software program whereby the pixels could be projected onto the canvases. So you basically now can walk into this gallery and see the murals as Rothko had intended, all by turning on a switch.
Is this is the whole concept controversial? I don't mean just in painting a la this Rothko thing, but obviously touching up. I mean, I assume that's a great controversy in the art world where I don't spend much of my time, sadly. Is it, yes?
It is, and actually, this is what I love about Harvard, is that they're raising the controversy because Harvard Art Museums is a teaching museum.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time it's ever been done to works of art. It's been done to tapestries, from what I understand, but never work of art. And so one of the concerns is that this will change expectations. If you have people coming in to see these now perfect, seemingly perfect murals, is that going to change people's expectations as they view ancient pieces of art all around the world? Pieces for which this cannot be done because they don't necessarily have the paint studies to show what the original colors were. So it does pose a lot of questions about what you do with works. Would Rothko have wanted this because he also designed these murals just to be in this particular space, although they have recreated it with the same configurations, the same olive mustard wall color that he chose. But it does change expectations.
Can you know, Marjorie said she doesn't get Rothko, and I was pretending like I do, and I have to say don't either.
It's just these rectangles of different colors, and I know, I mean, I took art history in college. I remember I almost flunked my modern American art. It was my last thing to graduate, and I remember being in a panic about Mark Rothko because I didn't get it then. I don't get it now, but it is, you know, have a light blue and underneath it a rectangle of darker blue and then a rectangle of a different color.
So
and
glad think, she's saying okay. this instead of me.
And I think, but what is it? What's the point? And
that's why Jared's here, Marjorie.
Yeah, I know he's an abstract expressionist and all that. I mean, I feel this way a lot, actually, in modern museums. When I go to the ICA, I think, okay, I spend my whole time there. What is the point? What is the point of Mark Rothko's rectangles of color? Do you know?
First of all, it's totally fine to say that. You need to say that because I don't respond to every piece of art. I don't understand every piece of art. I do a ton of research when I'm doing my pieces, so that's why I tend to understand more. But here's the challenge. We'll go to the museum.
Okay.
And if you go to the museum and you – Rothko created an environment so that you would have an experience. These murals are towering. Three of the murals are placed very, very close together so that you go in and you do have this experience in these wonderful shades of red. So it's not necessarily just a block of red, but you see the way he worked with color there. There you're seeing, I don't know how many colors, but you're seeing so many colors that he worked with. And so you see these little shades and how they bleed into the black and really different shades of red so that when you go in and if you get close to the murals, which you certainly are entitled to, you do have this experience. I think you feel the power of the art because it's not just one color that he's put on the canvas.
All right, I should go back and re-examine my relationship with Mark Rothko, and maybe it will change my life, Jim.
I think Jared was embarrassed for you. Have you ever, Jared, before you go...
I'm embarrassed for myself all the time,
if
so
you
it's
ever
okay.
go... We're not talking about rectangles anymore, but before you leave, have you ever touched a piece of art that you were not supposed to? Because I have, actually, and it was one of the most thrilling things ever. And the reason...
He was almost arrested.
No, it was a Michelangelo thing.
Michelangelo.
I told you this at the Vatican, and it was the days when there wasn't as much security, like 15 years ago, and you touch something, I know you're not supposed to, and you say to yourself... My hand is touching something that Michelangelo touched with his hands.
What did you touch? The Pietà?
I don't know what it was. But in any case.
Jesus and the
arms
of Mary?
No, I don't know what it was. But have you ever touched anything you weren't supposed to tell the truth?
Yes.
What'd you touch?
I don't remember, but I have been in situations where the curator has allowed me to,
oh, really?
To do it. Yeah.
You ever done it disallowed?
I'm sure I have. You know what I did? Well, I wasn't supposed to touch. They have this book made out of human skin at the Boston Athenaeum. Did you know about this book?
No.
I heard about it.
Yeah. And I wasn't supposed to touch that, and I did.
Did I ever tell you
How
about
How could you not?
How'd
it feel?
It felt soft and supple.
We don't have time, but I will tell you next time you hear Jared about the time I kissed the Mona Lisa. It was really, really exciting.
Jared Bowen, thank you as always for coming in. Jared Bowen is WGBH Arts Editor. Thank you again, Jared, and thank you for listening for another edition of Boston Public Radio. Heads up for movie buffs. Tomorrow we continue our classic movie challenge with Garen Daly asking you if 2001 A Space Odyssey still holds up today. So if you watch it, you now have a deadline. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. Our team, Chelsea Murris, Will Rosen, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen, our engineer, John Parker. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
Thanks again for listening, and please listen again tomorrow. See you later.